I got a bunch of battles going on. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mr. Chairman, I move to approve the Rock County check sheet for November 13, 2018. Cycle dates, November 5th through November 9th. Accounts payable checks in the amount of $2,859,359.44. Payroll checks, manuals, $6,196.46. IRS and state income tax wires in the amount of $3,161.41 for total disbursements approved of $2,868,717.31.
Second.
Item is noted, Tom.
Yes, sir. I must bring your attention. First, payment to Avtec Electronics. This is from the motor pool budget, and this was from the for the decommission of two units and then to install radios and systems in a new unit, 993, $4,742.18. Payment to Baseline Engineering Corporation, this is from building and plant budget. Fairgrounds Phase 2, and this is engineering for the bid and the site review, $1,216.25.
For the bid, for the what?
This is for
the
them.
Parks, I mean the...
For them to set the proposal and talk with the, to meet with the, those that were going to bid on the proposal.
Which proposal?
The RFP for Phase 2 of the fairgrounds.
That's taking them that long to get us a bill for that?
Yes.
Okay.
Baseline Engineering. Environmental payment to Environmental Systems Research Institute, that's ESRI. This is from a GIS budget, this upgrade of the ArcGIS software and the basic service package, $7,000 for that cost. Payment to High Country Engineering, Inc. This is from the public works budget and road and bridge project for the Green Trust Bridge design, $10,449.80. Payment to Russell's Auto Salon. This is from the motor pool budget, and this is a repair of a sheriff vehicle 879, $7,370.78. Payment to City of Steamboat Springs. This is for from the building and plant pool and the CLEF project. This is for costs related to the garage and the comm center facilities, and payments made to Northwest Colorado Consultants, Calcon, Steamboat Architectural Associates, NV5, YVEA, and the City of Steamboat Springs for utilities costs. Total payment or reimbursement to the city, $9,991.78. Payment to Smyzer Gordon Meyer Public Work Pool. This is the infrastructure pool. This is for bridge design on five small structures. And this payment was $16,006.50. Payment to UMB Bank and Trust. This is again from the building and plant pool. This is for the principal and interest on bonds for the Justice Center. So $1,109,539.45. Payment to West Route Fire District. This is from the wildfire budget for the Irwin Fire from September 2nd through the 24th of this year, 2018. Payment $24,763.89. Payment to Tolan Mechanical Systems. This is for facilities management budget and repair of the Justice Center solar heater, solar water heater, and heat exchanger and tandem compressor. So this was actually on the jail system. $18,942. Payment to GNS Mechanical, Inc. This is from YVRA. This is for a repair of the baggage handling equipment, replacement, and including some mechanical and electrical system programming controls, $36,482.50. And finally, a payment to Management of America, LLC. This is from the accounting budget, and this is for the cost allocation study, $4,250. All these items were included in the sheet that I emailed you last Thursday for your review. On Friday, we had a manual payment came through that Dan reviewed and signed off on. And the one payment on here that I just pointed out to you was a payment to the City of Steamboat Springs. And this is a distribution of regional building department fees collected. And the payment to the city is $37,211.31. And this is included in the sheet you have for your approval this morning.
Any questions? Comments? All those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Aye. So, items of note, yesterday's, we didn't have any meetings yesterday with recognition of Veterans Day, and so.
Mr. Chair, I move that we approve consent agenda items A and B.
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Okay, we're here with our 11 o'clock item with the assessor, Gary Peterson, and we're talking about abatement, and we got a consideration to approve or deny the following petition for abatement. Would be the Fisher abatement, R817-1515. So, Gary?
Okay. What we have here is essentially a double taxation going on. In 2002... a land swap occurred between two property owners. A platted 35-acre or 37-acre lot for Mystic Ridge subdivision and an adjacent large acreage ranch parcel known as Gray Ranch. They swapped an equal 6.71 acres of property, with the large ranch getting part of lot four, Mystic Ridge, and then Mystic Ridge owner getting a meets and bounds description in that land swap. Our office at the time processed these two deeds. They were filed 2 days apart and basically recognized it as a land swap and changed our legal description to read now part of lot four, Mystic Ridge subdivision, comma, 6.71 acres and a tract in the southwest northwest quarter, blah blah blah. 5 years later, the owners of the Mystic Ridge parcel were settling a divorce, and the husband had quick claimed his interest in the property to his wife, and that quick claim deed is part of your documents. And in the front of the front page of the deed, it lists the properly legal description of the property as part lot four, Mystic Ridge subdivision, comma, tract in the southwest northeast quarter, section 31785. And then on the back, it has Exhibit A, legal description. There's no reference on the front of the deed to an Exhibit A. Okay. And Sarah and I had just gone to advanced title class about a month ago. We brought this up as an example. Do I treat this as an erroneous deed? The attorney that teaches the class says, no, everything on the front is proper deed. There's no reference on the front of the deed to the Exhibit A in the back. The Exhibit A legal description is describing that 6.7 acres. And she essentially said you can pretty much just ignore that Exhibit A because it's not referenced. Your deed is good. So with that guidance and speaking with planning, I speak to planning about this because we're dealing with a platted subdivision. You know, that shouldn't be torn apart and stuff. And I talked to the plan. I said, I just want to take it back to 2002. We had recognized it then. And, you know, I'd like to just put it back. Do they have to go to you? And I guess I jumped ahead here. So what happened with this deed and where the mistake occurred in our office is my title administrator, who was new at the job at the time of the 2007 closing, or the deed coming through, took this Exhibit A as splitting off 6 acres from the parcel and created this new account. So for those time period between 2007 and 2015, 16, 17, it was being classified as ag property, and they were paying the bill on that. The 35 acres with the lot or with the house on it was also an ag. They were paying it. They didn't realize anything. And then, and starting with 16, we revoked the ag classification on both parcels due to lack of ag activity. And at the, about the same time, Mrs. Homeowner,
Fisher,
Julie Fisher, she also shut down that mailing P.O. box account that we had on the 6 acres. So she wasn't receiving the tax bills or the notices on it.
That's because we forced her to put a road name on it.
Okay. So it went to a tax sale. It didn't go to tax sales. She got a delinquent notice, ended up paying the back taxes and the interest, and then she was coming to us asking, you know, why is this being valued? So it went from very small ag assessment to a vacant at market value, and thus very, very large tax.
So was it vacant as a buildable lot value?
Well, we valued as a buildable lot.
Which
it could not have been. So it was erroneous valuation at that, and then I checked with the appraiser. The value that the land coach he uses for these Mystic Ridge lots, that didn't change, so it was being valued the same as if it was 30 acres or it was 37 acres. So that's why I say essentially it's a double taxation. And basically this lot does not exist. It should have never been split out and a property schedule created for it, and should not have been assessed going back to 2007. But it was. You can only go back 2 years on the thing, and luckily for this property owner, it's the 2 years that that it went to a vacant market assessment and some very high tax dollars. So my recommendation is that we...
So do we get this merged then, too? That's another thing that happens in your office.
Well, yeah.
He's saying it never got unmerged.
Well, I talked to planning, and they, to begin with, Mystic Ridge subdivision never went through the county's planning review. Didn't have to. It was created.
35,
just split it into 35 or larger, given a subdivision name. And then when they did the land swap, technically we should have said no back in 2002 and said, because this involves a platted subdivision, you should deal with planning. That didn't occur. Our office just recognized the land swap. And so my conversations with Christy in planning was, I just want to take it back to 2002. We had recognized the land swap.
So we're going to have to take some action to make that happen at some future date.
I don't think so. Christy was... Oh. She talked to Chad. They were fine with just, like, letting it be as it was in 2002 and the legal description reading part of Lot 4 of Mystic Ridge and 6.7 acres meets and bounds for a total of 36.8 acres.
So you guys have then constructively created a merge then between the 30, used to be 37, went down to 30, and then about back up to 37.
He's saying that it never went down.
Well, that land swap occurred, the two deeds were filed 2 days apart, and I don't know which one came in first, but yes, technically it should have been stopped there as an, you know, and say you got to go through planning review.
And that's fine, too. So another question then. So is there still two parcels existing in your database, or is there one parcel?
We have deactivated 6.7 acres.
Okay. And made the other one 37 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. We corrected our acreage for the current year at 18. We've corrected the acreage of the house parcel back up to the 38 or 37 acres. And we deactivated this subject parcel that's under abatement for 18, and upon your approval, and the abatement gets fully processed. Well, it's just it's deactivated as of 1/1/2018.
Seems that.
I'm good.
And the, at least as far as the abatement is concerned, it seems straightforward enough. So, Mr. Chairman, in the matter of account number R8171515, I would move to approve the abatement requested for both tax years 2016 and 2017, which reduces or removes the assessment in its entirety, taking the valuation to zero. The refund amount would be $2,388.64 for tax year 2016 and $2,689.96 for tax year 2017.
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Yeah, nothing like a $2,000 bill. Here we got our 1115 item, Rob County Personnel Handbook Definitions Update. So, Kathy, start off with you.
So, I'm here for you to consider to approve an update to the Personnel Handbook Section 2 Definitions, 2.1 Accrual Period. Due to the road and bridge in the Yucca Valley Regional Airport Department's busy winter schedules, we updated their policy. They have a supplemental policy, so their accrual begins on November 1st and goes through October 31st for any vacation and comp time accrual. We would like to include holidays, so they're all on the same schedule. So we are making an edit to the definitions, or we're recommending that we make an edit to the definitions to accrual include holiday for that period.
I am aware with what we're doing, and I have no questions.
So I guess my only question here, so I mean, we periodically do these changes and the rest. How do we know that you have the latest, and that we all have the latest and greatest version of the document? Is that numbered, and or do we give annual updates to all the employees at the end of the, at the start of a new year? Or?
We. It is a good question. It is a good question.
I mean, I don't hate to throw it out at you too much, because I mean, so maybe we need to come up with a plan for
that.
Well,
is the online version always accurate?
So let's just say, right now, typically we try and do it every year when we make a list of all the changes that have happened.
Right.
And oftentimes, a policy is sent out right after it's approved for people to just see that it
is updated. The individual policy change.
Right. However, we like to get receipt that somebody actually reviewed the updates. And we are in the process of working to have that go through Munis so we can get an electronic update. Otherwise, we have to get a signed piece of paper every single time we update the handbook.
Even if you send it out email with a read receipt, that's not good enough?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
So we are in between processes, so I would have to say we are not current on everybody having seen every change that has happened within the last year.
Okay. Well, that's a separate issue. I mean, this particular change makes good sense.
Mr. Chair, I recommend that we approve the edits to the Route County Personnel Handbook, Section 2, Definitions 2.1, Accrual Period.
Second.
Just clarification, we're not recommending, we're actually approving that,
yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Recommend to ourselves.
Yeah.
So you have a motion and second. Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
Can bring five chairs up.
Jeff, Mike, why don't you guys all come up? Join us up here at the table if you could. Bring a couple more chairs. Bring a chair up.
Let me give you a
copy
chair.
A copy chair?
Yeah.
Well,
might not be there.
I can take the last company. You take the company.
Chris, please.
All right, I'll get on one that's a little higher off the ground. That makes it better.
I don't bite.
I'll be here like a kindergarten.
I hope you do.
Okay.
So has everybody met everybody? Mike, I know you. Jeff, I know you.
Jim, I'm Doug Monger.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
Mary Beth?
Thank you.
Is it Mary Beth, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm Tim.
Nice to meet you.
This is my brother, Tim.
Nice to meet you.
Carrie Hermansen's.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, Kim.
Nice to meet you, Greg.
What's your first name?
Jeff.
Jeff with a G.
Jeff with a G.
That throws everything in
there. John,
I'm going to see if Eric can come over real briefly after this.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah, I do. And I don't know you.
I'm Tim Gargan.
Huh?
Tim Gargan.
Okay, Tim.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Long time no see, guys.
We just managed
my phone. Yeah, last night, right?
County manager comes all over.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Sorry, I'm kind of blocking.
That's
iPad there.
So wait till we get Lene in here, so then we can get started off.
We're 5 minutes early.
You found a replacement, I see, for the...
Say what?
You found a replacement for the...
For Tegan, yeah.
Yep.
Tegan?
It was Tegan. This is Sarah.
Sarah.
Oh, hi. Hi there. Welcome to the circus.
Well,
we'll be doing the high water act this afternoon.
The waterboarding comes later.
Lene is coming over, and then Eric's going to come over after that and show us.
Well, I don't know any reason why we can just go ahead and get kicked off.
She's here.
It's Kevin. So we're here with our, so my mic's still been on. So we're here with our 11:30 item, funding approval for PDR Project 186, the Flanders Project. So Claire, we'll start off with you, if you could.
This concerns the Flanders Ranch, and this is a wonderful project, and suffice it to say we're extremely excited and very grateful that these folks are moving forward with this project. It's been a couple of years of working through some significant details, and they've hung in there. Really, truly appreciate that. Our level of funding is $400,000, and the acreage of the project is 1,677, close enough, acres, and it's prime wildlife habitat. There's a number of acres of irrigated hayland. And it does support a working ranch, a cattle ranch of about 100 head. Is that correct?
We don't quite have 100 head right now.
Okay.
It would, on a good year, support 100 head. This year, it didn't support quite so many.
Okay. And it's been in the family since 1954. Am I right about that? And so we've got a multi-generation family. They are absolutely committed to preserving the landscape, maintaining the agricultural operation, the ranching family. And then they have also made a commitment to work with CPW on additional access to the property for the public. And so we're really, really excited about this project. Our contribution is 10.4%, and the landowner's contribution is 20%, and they were funded in a great deal by CPW through GOCO. So, Kurt, do you want to say that?
Yeah.
So, real, very pleased, very happy to see this project moving forward.
So I had in earlier discussions expressed some reservations about proceeding with the project until we have the access agreement in place, but I've come around to the idea that the conservation easement stands on its own even without the access agreement. But I would really encourage you folks to follow through with CPW and try to get that access agreement into place.
Well, it is every intention for us to go ahead with the access agreement. It's not us that was holding it up.
I understand. Yeah, we understand that there's issues.
We understand the politics.
The Attorney General's office.
It's more us asking you to keep hanging in there.
Just, yeah. Just,
as you have been for 2 years.
Yeah, and we appreciate you.
4 years.
Yeah, and I will chime in. I mean, TNC is committed to working with this family and helping them, and we're going to all together ride herd on CPW and make sure this gets done. Both parties are very interested.
I think it's admirable that you hung in there because I think clearly this easement, even without public access, stands on its own. So I'm in full support of it.
Mm-hmm. So I know that one of the potential hang-ups is in the Capital Development Committee in the State Senate.
Yes.
Let us know if there's anything we can do. Speaking with our legislators and folks down there at the Capitol when the time comes,
so that
we can get this pushed through.
Good to hear. That hearing is scheduled for January at this point, and we're anticipating to get it on.
Or maybe.
Well, yeah, that's our hope.
Their hope, yeah.
Well, right now, that's what we're looking toward. And
please keep us in the loop, because, I would be happy to go down there and sit in front of the committee in case that helps.
And the word we're getting from state staff is that their intention is to move this through and
Great. Well, we appreciate you guys hanging in there.
It's been quite a ride.
So, are you, Mr. Chairman, you ready for a motion?
So, I guess my comment would be, and I sympathized or appreciated Commissioner Corrigan's comments, but our position on this is it's a PDR fund and it's a PDR project, and not necessarily that wasn't riding contingent upon the access easement that happens as well. And I know Commissioner Corrigan likes to see some access on those and in public enjoyment of potential of those properties as well, but that isn't necessarily what the conservation easement is protecting as well. So I think we needed to keep them separate, and I'm happy that we're moving forward with the thing as well, and we're getting that part closed off. And then again, agree with Commissioner Corrigan, if we need to have some lobbying efforts at the Capitol Committee, with the Senate Capitol Committee, we'd be happy to provide some of that as well. Even a letter or whatever. So,
my only concern is I'd hate to be over in Doug's place and look up on that hill and see light here.
Well, and that is the purpose of the program, is to keep open space. So
productive
open space.
Well,
yeah.
So yes.
Well, and this PDR grant has really made this thing happen, and so we're all very appreciative that the people in Rouse County are committed to this, and you guys are committed to it, and you see the benefit of these kinds of actions. And but without that, I'm not sure this would have been possible.
And it's tremendous leverage from our point of view. $400,000 goes a long ways in this particular.
Yeah.
So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would move to approve the funding of PDR project number 186, the Flanders project, in the total amount of $400,000 towards the purchase of a conservation easement and authorization to sign the agreement concerning conservation easement between Rouse County and the Nature Conservancy.
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 That's fine. I'm good at crossing down. So.
Did you say you mumbled, Doug? Was that an aye?
That was an aye, yeah.
Oh.
And I don't know if you recall this map in the application package, but this just really, really emphasizes the critical importance of this piece
connector.
Of land,
yep.
As far as the contiguity for the big game habitat and greater sage grouse and all of that. I mean, it's just phenomenal to have that significantly and with no reservations on the property.
Right.
Other than the existing ranch headquarters area.
That's beginning to look like the map in South Rouse, where these are linked and
we are close to
landscape scale conservation. So that's great.
So when's our proposed closing time? Do we know?
27th of November.
Oh, well, good.
Yeah.
Great.
Right around the corner.
Come over and have
everyone.
Thanksgiving cocktail with me or something.
That sounds like a good idea. Yeah. Although the liquor cabinet in Port is stocked.
Is it? Okay, that's all right. I'll come sit on the porch with you, Mike.
That sounds like a good idea. As long as the wind's not blowing.
There you go. Well, thank you all for your
thank support. You very much. We really appreciate your support.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Bye-bye.
Jim, nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Well, you ought to remember me.
Say what?
You ought to remember.
So we have our 1 o'clock agenda item here. We have Anne Marie, the Director of the Public Health Partnership, is going to be making a presentation to us.
Yeah.
Start off with that.
All right. So I don't know, in your packets, I'm thinking you might already have these slides. Is that correct?
Yep. Yes.
Okay. And I brought a couple of other handouts I might share throughout. So let me just get those up. All right. All right. So first of all, I just want to say thank you for inviting us to come. I have been in this role as the Director of Local Public Health Partnerships, which is just a fancy way of saying I get to go out to all the communities across the state and be the liaison with all the health departments and the commissioners and the boards of health. And I love that job. It's been really great. I grew up in a rural community in Arkansas and lived in an area where I felt like rural sometimes gets left out of the picture, especially in the bigger cities. And so it was important to me when I applied for this position to really make sure that that's kind of stated and we work from that frame where we are really making sure that everyone across the state gets what they need to be healthy. I want to make sure you guys have a chance to introduce yourselves.
Sure. I'm Kate Lujan. I am a public health nurse consultant. I'm on the western slope, so I cover the west side of the state. And I've been in that role for about 12 years. I lived in rural and frontier Colorado for the last 30, so I kind of understand.
Frontier Colorado?
Frontier. So I cover the frontier. Burns? You're familiar with Burns?
Burns?
Yeah, I lived in Burns.
You lived in Burns?
I lived in Burns.
There's precious few of you that make that
I know.
I spent a lot of time around Burns.
Isn't that beautiful?
That's yes, our yeah. frontier.
Okay, so that's where I first moved. Well, I lived in Frisco, too, when it was a lot, 30 years ago, obviously. And now I live in Fruta. So I'm familiar with calm, quiet, peaceful, and I like it. So.
Yeah. Great, thanks, Kate.
Keith Simpson, I'm the Environmental Health Liaison for the Office of Planning Partnerships and Improvement. So I work with all the environmental health programs around the state, for the whole state. But still, it's public health, so we do all of public health. Prior to that, I worked as an environmental health director in southeast Colorado, the other corner of the state, covered the four counties in southeast Colorado. So very familiar with rural communities. And I was told very specifically when I was hired that much of the reason that there was a factor in me being hired was my local experience in working in rural communities as well. I've lived in small communities most of my life. I do live in Denver now, Denver area, I should say. But most of my growing up life was spent summers, weekends, and holidays a small town of 500 people in Central Kansas farming with my dad and my grandparents. So understand the small community and rural areas very well.
Now, we start with that because we know when we come into these settings, like this is our 16th training for local boards of health around the state. And when we come in, you know, we've got the state plaster on our forehead and like, oh, the state's here to do, you know, but we're
and
like.
You start seeing us glossy.
Totally. We get it. So
you're
I guess.
From the state and you're here to help us.
Yes, right.
Exactly.
Yes. Government. Yeah, I have I can't even say what it said because it had some profanity in it. But in Meeker, there was a great little I'll have to tell you about it some other time, but it's really funny talking about the state.
Yeah, let's move the microphone over.
Yeah, right, exactly. So I guess, you know, the reason we start with that again is just we just want you to know that we're not just these people from the big city who feel like we're here to tell you what to do. That's not at all our job. In fact, the reason why we all work for this office is it's a very unique office. It almost serves as an ombudsman type of a deal. It's with the, all the different health divisions within our department. We don't sit within any of those. We're kind of off to the side, and our job is to really help and support local communities and help them make sure they're meeting the Public Health Act, which we'll talk about in a minute. And I know you all are familiar with some of this already, so I'll go through some of it quick. But I do want to make sure that we're giving this, delivering the same message to all the commissioners and boards of health around the state. So we'll go through. So if you're like, yep, got it, we'll move forward. And then we might stick on a couple other slides a little more. We'll see how that goes. So, again, thanks for having us. I just want to say thanks to you guys. Like, you've been awesome. It's been great working with them. And, you know, just to level set a little bit about kind of how we got here today, I think we're all here, of course, to ensure that the people of Route County get what they need to be healthy, make sure the environment is in a good place. And I think there's no question about that. I will say, the minute I started this job, you know, you're like, okay, tell me about these different communities. This was one of the ones that was like, we kind of don't really know exactly what happens up there. There was a little confusion about how money goes to Northwest Colorado Health, and then they do this, and where does the director, but then Environmental Health's over here. There was just some confusion about how that all works. And so when I first started, I came out and visited Charity, who was in the role, in Craig. And the first time, you know, I went out to meet her, and on that day she's like, yeah, I'm leaving. and then Lisa was leaving, and so Stephanie was new, and then they hired Carrie, and then Scott, you've only been here for a few years too, really. So, and then I was new in my role. So I think with all of us new folks coming in going, how does this all work? There have just been some questions that have come up, and I'm like, how do you guys do this? And, you know, we're just learning about it. So I think it was when I came for the State Board of Health, there were some questions that had come up from members about how everything works up here. And so out of that, somebody so graciously offered, well, why don't you come up, let's talk about it. And so again, we come in peace. This is not a where is the state kind of position. So so I just wanted to kind of level set there. Yeah, so that's good. So let's go ahead and get started with the slides. So again, the word partnering is, you know, italicized here because I really can't stress that enough. That's really how we see ourselves. It's also outlined in the statute that local and state has to partner together to really make this happen. We can't do it without one another. So this is a quick overview. I am going to ask for any burning questions you have, or just questions. It might not be that burning, but we are going to talk about what public health is, because I think a lot of times, even if you ask the state health department, you ask everyone what that was, everyone would say something just a little different. And so I just want to make sure we're all on the same page about that.
Number 6is kind of ironic.
Okay,
no.
So we'll talk about that when we get there. So then, you know, the Public Health Act, local public health agencies role, the local board of health role, and then treasurer and legal counsel. We do have a couple slides on that. So really quickly, I just want to start with, I know some of you have been doing this a lot longer than others, but what do you have any questions that you were hoping? I really wanted to hear about X today. Is there anything specific?
Not yet.
Okay, great. I just want to make sure I touch upon that.
Don't, you know, and we'll stop to interrupt you if we need.
That is fine. I am. Just, I was.
No, don't take it personally. It,
oh, I was one of 5 children in an Italian family.
Oh, okay.
So yes, I'm an interrupter, and I'm always like, I'm sorry, but it comes in my head, it comes out my mouth. So, this is just a quick picture of what public health is. It's a lot, and it's not just one thing. It's about making sure that everyone has the opportunity to live a healthy life in a healthy community where there's opportunities everywhere. So can we, for the video, how do we play this? Is there a way to do that? We have this video that was developed that I think does a really good job.
You played this at the event at the library, right?
I did, sorry.
One button.
Well, while we're waiting.
And we can, yes.
Yeah, thanks for coming up.
Yeah.
I think I maybe talked to you briefly about this when you were in Steamboat. When was that? A month or so ago?
Yeah, a couple months ago.
A couple months ago?
July.
It's just the lack of really a fundamental understanding of what our duties are as the Board of Public Health, and this is helpful.
Good.
I mean, I know a lot more now than I did then, you know, as we've dug into this a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's more to learn.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, the way these trainings got started is I was asked to go to Fremont County when I was first in the role. I was literally on my second week, and Debbie Bell, who's one of the commissioners there, was sitting next to me at a meeting, and something about public health got brought up, and she leaned over to me and said, "So we serve as the Board of Health, and we don't know what we're doing." Like, it's basically what she said. She was like, "How can you come train us? Because we mean well, we want to do the right thing, but we actually have no idea what we're really what our role is." And I was like, "Yeah."
Well, I think we were north of that.
Yes, but you are from everything I've heard. But I'm just sharing, like, that's how it came up, with someone just being honest, which I appreciated. And I said, "Yeah, let's get together and talk about it." So the format for these, as I was telling, I think Scott or Carrie this morning, like, I really like it when it's more just conversational and it's learning and it's, yep, I know about that, but tell me about this. You know, we don't want it to be this. We don't even use PowerPoint every time. Although this video is really good, so I did want to show it. But if it's a problem, we can just pull up the,
this thing works much better.
Oh, wow. Look at that fancy thing. We could also just move forward and I can skip it if we need to.
I mean, I think the one thing that we've figured out so far is that our duties, while they may be set out in words, they're still pretty vague and subjective.
Yep.
As to, are we actually fulfilling those duties?
Absolutely.
What part of it are we supposed to be doing? Are we doing too much? Are we doing too little?
Yeah.
My guess is you're not going to actually answer that question.
Not fully, but the whole purpose of the assessment process is for you to answer that question as a community. So if there's a process we go through called CHAPS, if you're familiar with that, okay? So that whole process, going through that to figure out what are the needs of your community within the Public Health Act and those core services, you identifying, you know what, this we're pretty good at, you know, we don't really need to focus, but with the limited dollars we get and we invest in, this is something we can do.
So in other words, we decide.
You decide. Yes.
You're not going to come and tell us exactly.
No.
There's a discretionary level of service.
Yeah, there are the core services, which all. That's part of my presentation, too, that we'll go into a little bit of detail on. But, yeah, it's very open. So we'll talk about it.
Hello. Welcome to this video where we're going to talk about public health. Public health has made a significant impact on the health of populations, making people healthy and saving lives. For example, in the United States, between 1900 to 1999, people's life expectancy has increased by over 30 years. Did you know that 25 of these extra years gained are due to public health interventions? So in this video, we're going to take a look at what public health is, how it's different to clinical medicine, who's responsible for doing it, and how it's done. First of all, let's have a look at what health is. The World Health Organization defines health as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, rather than a mere absence of disease or infirmity. This is a pretty bold and ambitious definition that prompts people to look beyond diseases and focus not only on the physical aspect of health, but also on the mental and social aspects as well. And public health? Well, public health is the science and art of preventing disease, prolonging life, and promoting health through the organized efforts of society. Okay, so how is it different to clinical medicine? Let's take a look at an example. Let's say someone has an accident and has a broken leg. A clinician's main focus is the immediate health problem, fixing the fractured leg. Clinicians focus on the individual. The public health approach would be holistic and would focus on figuring out how and why this person had an accident, so that actions can be taken to prevent it from happening again. For example, why did he have the accident? Was there a problem with his vision? Was it poor knowledge of driving skills or bad attitudes towards driving? Was he under the influence of alcohol or drugs when he was driving? Are there laws against this and resources to enforce it? What are the community expectations or attitudes towards driving? Does he have a good social support network that will help in his recovery or prevent this from happening again? Was the road he was driving on safe? Was he driving a safe car that was well-maintained? If not, why not? Could he not afford it? If not, why could he not afford it? Does he have a job that doesn't pay well? Why is that? Is it because he did not have access to good education? Was there good access to health services which would determine his treatment and recovery? As you can see from this example, health is determined by a complex interaction between many different factors or determinants of health. These include individual characteristics, lifestyle and behaviors, and also the physical, social, and economic environments, the social determinants of health. In order to make a difference in health, there's action needed across all the different determinants. Public health focuses on these upstream factors to make changes that can benefit the health of the population as a whole. This seems like a very broad and complex task, doesn't it? So, who's responsible for public health? Ultimately, the responsibility of creating a healthy community rests with all sectors of society. Health departments do have a central role in public health. However, improving the health of a population requires the coordinated efforts of a broad range of stakeholders. This includes other areas of government, the private sector, non-governmental organizations, international organizations, and communities, to name a few, all united with a shared goal of improving the health of the public. Now let's have a look at how public health works. The World Federation of Public Health Associations has developed a useful framework to understand how public health is delivered. There are three core service areas of public health and a group of enablers that ensure that these services can occur effectively and efficiently. The three core areas of public health are protection, promotion, and prevention. Protection is about protecting the health of the population. This includes the control of infectious diseases, managing environmental hazards, ensuring a healthy workplace, and managing health emergencies. Promotion is about improving the health of the population. It covers a broad range of activities that not only focuses on the individual, like promoting health behaviors over a life course, it also focuses on improving the social determinants of health. Prevention is about preventing health issues before they occur. It includes activities such as vaccination and screening. To enable these core areas to function, there needs to be good governance, advocacy to influence and obtain support and commitment for actions that support a health goal, capacity, having an adequate, well-trained, and supported public health workforce, and having accurate, timely information to support health actions such as relevant research, surveillance, monitoring, and evaluation. So that's a quick introduction to the fascinating field of public health. Yep. We've had a look at what it is, how it's different to clinical medicine, who's responsible for doing it, and how it's done.
Okay, so did you learn anything new in that, or do you feel like, yep, we totally knew all that?
Mostly.
You yep. did?
Totally knew all that.
Knew good. All that.
Okay, good. What are some of the programs you feel like you guys do really well in public health that address the population?
I think we're good. We've been doing great with vital statistics or private records, right?
Yeah. Birth and death records?
Yeah.
That is important, yeah.
What was the question again?
Like, I was just asking, since that's something that's not new, and I'm wondering what programs do you feel like Route County does really well that address the population as a whole?
Well, that's probably a great question, and the answer is, we don't really know
what we're doing well.
Okay. We do restaurant inspections locally instead of the state.
Yeah,
we do that really
true.
Well, and all the restaurants really like that service.
Right.
I think the community itself does a lot of that itself.
Yeah.
Not through us so much, but the community has a good backstop and all that. And self-sufficient and gold standard and the rest. So
Colorado Great. Northwest Health has been on my radar since I was a kid growing up in Maupin County, and so he's been a really strong presence in the community.
Yeah. And what kind of prevention programs and health promotion programs do they do that are public health?
Even when I was a child, they would go out and visit young mothers.
The nurse family home visit
mothers,
program.
New mothers, I should say, in the homes. And I remember as a kid going in for probably scoliosis screening, and the boys and girls school kids took us down to VNA her
yeah.
for different types of screenings.
And, great.
And I know that that's only grown.
Good, yeah. Cool. Okay,
thanks.
We pull up the... Oh, they're over here.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's nice that this chair swivels, so I just do that. Okay. Let's get back to where my pointing was, I guess, so. Okay, so you guys know it's not medical care then. It focuses on the entire population. So whenever you're thinking about the programs that we're funding with public health, how is this program addressing the whole population is the question you definitely want to be asking. It's also not just for poor and underserved. I think a lot of people think public health is like a gap, you know, fills the gap, and that we really are looking at the most underserved populations. Not that those are not very important populations to look at, but it should be serving all of us. It's good for all of us, right? Like the restaurant inspections is a really good example of that. You know, we all eat in the restaurants, and so how do we make sure that they're safe food? One thing I do want to ask, which I already addressed that before I do this, is the return on investment. There's been a lot of research on return on investment, and so I just pulled out a couple of things just to share. So, for instance, every time a foodborne illness is found at a restaurant, it costs the restaurant on average $70,000. So that's a pretty expensive thing. So public health, the restaurant inspections that you guys are doing locally, like you said, those are really helping save dollars. Also, I know years ago, and I don't know how strong it is now, but the early childhood development and health and development, you all had a very strong early childhood council here at one point. I don't know where that stands now. Yeah, so I just remember seeing that it was a really strong program. And so for every dollar that you're spending on early childhood health and development, you're saving $9 in future spending, which is a return on investment of 800%. And then tobacco, I know this one's used a lot, but with tobacco, that's there's been a lot of research on that one, of course. And so every dollar invested in tobacco saves up to $20 in future health costs, and that's a return on investment of 1,900%. So there's a lot more than just those two, but I just wanted to highlight a few of them, that this whole working upstream and not just working with at the individual level really does save a lot of money in the long run and prevents negative health for the whole community. So you guys are probably familiar with this. The left side is the 10 essential services of public health, and that's the how we do our work. The right, those are the core services that you were talking about, that within administration and governance, assessment and planning, communicable disease, and all around, you are to determine that there is guidance in the Board of Health rules that say these are the kind of things you should be doing, but you all determine with what's happening in our county, we really need to focus on these with the money we have. We know that public health, the state is not funding public health at the level it needs to be. In fact, there's something that's coming down the pike, and I think I talked about this at the meeting, which is called public health transformation. We're actually going to the legislature and going to ask for more funding for all local communities. This is driven by locals. It's not driven by the state, but we're partnering because we agree 100% that there should be more funding. You all don't get a lot of funding just to open your doors for public health, you know, which is why a lot of times there's shared services and folks are passing the dollars through to another entity because you don't have money just to have a public health agency. So we're trying to remedy that. The other thing is it's going to take these two models here, kind of merge them together. There's a model that's out there at the national level that the federal government is saying they're going to fund for states who adopt it, and so we're kind of on our way to do that. So that's a new, and we want to be ready. We want all the counties and everybody to be ready and understand what that means.
And we'll need to adopt that in order to qualify for federal funding.
Well, the state is going to adopt it. So right now, the thing on the right, that's what we as a state have adopted that's in Board of Health rules and regs. We are going to be going to the Board of Health in, I think, April, as it is right now, to present the other visual. The cool thing about the other visual is it's one visual besides, like, here's this thing we do, this is the how, and this is the what, because we have, you know, they're both called services, and it's a little bit confusing. The other just it simplifies it a little bit, and local directors like Carrie came to our community conversations and connections that we brought folks together to say, do you like this? Does this make sense? So local health departments have told us they don't have time to go out and like change the frameworks. They want us to do it, but they want to do it in partnership. So we've been going out saying, what do you think about this? And when we presented to the other commissioners, we've been sharing it too and talking to CCI. And so we're trying to make sure that this is something that is driven by the communities around the state, not by the state. But we're trying to do the work because folks don't have the capacity to do it. Although there's a lot who are volunteering time to work on it, which is great. So you're familiar with the Public Health Act. I will say the one we are not. One of the things that it did was it took our county nursing services, public health nursing services, and changed it to be from public health nursing services to be public health agencies. And so I assume you all know that, but I think I actually asked for the contract so I could kind of see where you guys were. It's still listed in the contract from Route to Northwest Colorado Health that they are to provide public health nursing services. So it's a little bit, it's language is a little bit outdated, so you might want to consider looking at the MOU and just updating it to really reflect the statute. The statute was established to ensure that all people receive high quality services, and we want to reduce healthcare costs. That was a big piece of is why it happened. I already mentioned that we share responsibility, the state and local together. Those are the required core services. So the statute said you must do core services, but we're going to let the State Board of Health determine what those are. So that's how the core services were developed by the State Board of Health. So those can be changed, which is what we're looking at modernizing a little bit. For instance, maternal and child health, when you were talking about nurse, family visitor, people visiting the home, maternal and child health is a very important public health service. Right now, it's not called out as its own thing. It's like buried under some things. In the new framework, maternal and child health is called out more prominently, which people really like. That's just one example. It also requires these assessments, so we talked about that too. Every community has to do their own assessment, and then the idea is you do the assessment based on the core services, and you look to see what do we need to be doing differently, or what do we strengthen, what challenges do we have, and then the idea is that the money follows that, right? Like, it doesn't make sense to do that, and we have a lot of counties that do that. They create this great plan. Here's what our priorities are. This is what we need to do, and if you follow, the money that comes, it doesn't do that. It does something totally different, and so it's really important as the Board of Health.
Money from your organization?
Yeah, like so.
From the State Board of
From both. I mean, ideally, if you are developing an assessment to put towards your public health, whatever your public health budget is, whether it's a little bit of local, a little bit of state, a little bit of sometimes federal, it's just grants, that money should reflect the support of that plan is the idea, right? So this assessment gets done, you develop this community health improvement plan, or a CHIP, I don't know, you might have heard that. That's the terminology local folks use with it. And then whatever is in that, the idea is that the money support, that's what the money goes to, like prioritized budgeting, that sort of thing. And then, of course, it defined the duties and powers of local health agencies and boards of health. And this is where that woman, Debbie Bell, was like, I don't know, what are they responsible for? What are we? Do we have to hire? Do they hire? There was just some questions around that. So we do have a handout that I did not send ahead of time because I did not have my stuff together. I'm sorry. Last week was a little crazy. But we printed some for you all. You guys can pass this out, too, which kind of helped a little bit with the Board of Health and then the Public Health Director and what those roles are. The thing about this was developed by, I didn't even know, there was a National Association of Local Boards of Health. And I like that it's got verbs, it kind of helps, with long-term goals, when you're creating a goal, the Board of Health approves those. You all are responsible for saying, yes, we agree that that's a long-term goal, but the Public Health Director recommends, provides input, looking at the health assessment. So this just, it goes on, annual report, you all approve it, but the Public Health Director assesses, develops, and carries it out. The budget, you all, of course, approve the budget, but the Public Health Director is to develop and recommend, what the dollars be spent on.
Do these national recommendations align with what is expected of us now?
I would say that's a really good question. We don't. This isn't like you must do this by us. Not at all.
Are some pieces that are in statute and regulation that align, but this is more recommendation.
Yeah.
Things nationally, but there's things in the state statute regulation that do match up to success.
Yeah. So, yeah, that would actually be a good one.
Yeah, it'd be nice to have
put little check marks to show you that. Yeah. And we could do that.
How we're functioning, isn't it? I mean,
well, I don't think so, because I know when Carrie first started, well, actually, I think you've been there a little while. I had asked her, so tell me about your budget. What do you spend? She didn't have any idea, because I think the structure that's been developed with Northwest Colorado Health is that some of those decisions are made higher than the public health director, which can be, isn't following statute necessarily. So that's something for you all to consider, how that works. But the public health director, should be doing some of these things that it sounds like people, that Carrie needs to get permission or isn't able to make decisions about some things just because of the way the structure is set up. Again, stuff that's happened before us. Any of us are even there. So it is something I think that would be good to kind of look at to see, you know, where is the authority, what authorities does the public health director have?
Where do you go to get that authority?
And some of this is talked about in the rest of our presentation,
yes,
too.
So okay,
there'll be pieces we're going to touch on. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt your question, Commissioner.
I just, for budget and, like, salaries, where do you go to get that permission?
I mean, that's more of a, in the past, I think we've approached it as, you know, one agency, and that's really done in that higher level. Like, our CFO does a lot of work on that, and then we would like, if there was something that she wanted to do in public health, we would have to go through our internal approval process. So I think this was brought up that maybe that's not the way
okay, because I mean, this is Board of Health. I mean, we have a contract with you guys. I mean, we don't tell you what salaries to pay. We give you that line item,
right?
And that's how it looks like. That's what's recommended.
Yeah. And then within that budget, we say, you know, yeah, we can do.
Yeah,
this.
I mean, if we had our own,
so
if we were handling that ourselves internally, we could check all these boxes. It's a little bit grayer when we entered into a contractual arrangement with Northwest Colorado Health.
And that's what we do. Like, if you take staff salaries, for example, right?
Yeah.
We give them a line item.
Yes.
They choose what to pay their...
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
It would be different if we were doing it internally.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, and it does get hardened. There are other... there are other agencies that share services and rely on other, like a larger entity. Well, you're the only one that passes through all dollars. So even Denver Health, which is Denver Department of Public Health and Environment, is their new name, asks Denver Public Health, the hospital, to do a lot of services. Like, you handle this, you handle this, you handle that. But the director is at the Denver Department. They report directly to the commissioners. So right now, Carrie reports to folks within her organization and doesn't always have the authority to make decisions on certain things because of the structure, again, of the way that everything is built. Is this right? Like,
which may not necessarily be a bad thing.
No. You just have to make sure that the statute. So, like, where I get concerned as a contract monitor or a support to this, just trying to make sure this is being done in alignment with the statute, is knowing that the person who has the most knowledge about public health and is the director, and we're asking directors to go do X, but then can't necessarily all do that because you have to go through the lines of authority to get to what you need. But it's not like things can't be remedied or worked on. It's just, it is one of those things in the statute that we have to just address. So
we can't neatly check the box.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't know. I don't think so. But from what you're saying and some of the questions that I've asked you, and, you know, not having answers to some of those things, it's just the way the structure has been. And so you just have to make sure that authority is given to the public health director to make sure to do those things. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Like that? Okay. So, again, agency, and this is a little different. So I left the graphic on the left because that is how most offices or agencies are developed. There's the Board of Health, and then they hire the director, and then there's a chief medical officer or some sort of medical, and you all have that, a medical advisor, and then the director hires the staff. So in between the Board of Health and the director, there's an organization. So that's the only thing that would be added there for Northwest Colorado Health. So that's the structure piece. And we kind of already talked about this, carrying out those, the duties and powers of the agency is to really implement those core services, which it sounds like that's what happens, right? Like, you all do the assessment, you all do the assessment, create the plan, hire the staff, advise the local Board of Health, so come to your meetings and say, hey, this is something that's happening, we need to work on X, Y, and Z, and connect to make sure that the public health and the environment is protected. Here's more. This is statute around duties and powers of local public health directors. So they need to be able to direct the resources to carry out a public health improvement plan, to estimate and submit the budget, so to develop a budget like we talked about. And this is all statute language. To ensure public health funding was spent on public health activities, per the statute, only the public health director and the local board of health can certify this. Administer and enforce the public health laws, and then exercise, you know, those legal powers, like if there's a you can close a school or a business due to some sort of an outbreak. There's some of those powers in there too. There's a lot more there's more powers than I think people realize that both the local board of health and then also the public health director have if there's something that happens in the community. So then here's the structure of the Board of Health that's different from that. So you all know this, I know already, but you all you both serve as the county commissioners and then also as the Board of Health. There are cases where, and this is not a suggestion, I just want to make sure you know what's happening around the state, that some local, after doing some of these trainings, some of the county commissioners who are serving as their Board of Health have asked us, well, can we appoint another Board of Health? Because some of them honestly didn't really know a lot about public health and felt like I'd rather delegate it, right, to have someone else kind of oversee that. And so in the statute it does say that as the county commissioners, you all have the authority to say, we're going to delegate, and you get to pick who's on it, that this board is now the Board of Health and still reports up to you. But there is an option for that, and so we want to make sure folks know that. That's the way it happens in some of the larger areas, and that we want to make sure that if that sort of thing occurred, that you want to reflect the diversity of the community. So not just having folks who maybe are in the medical field, but having environmental health folks there, education, housing, transportation, like, you know, different areas represented. Even community residents, that's one that's really big, is making sure that a community member is represented on some of the boards of health. So that's just a little bit about the structure. You all probably know this already, too. Meetings every 3 months with documentation. You can call a special meeting. You can adopt bylaws. Majority is a quorum, and then members cannot be compensated except for reimbursements and travel. The other thing is that the Board of Health is the group that selects the local public health director. They employ, contract, and secure the medical officer. They can hold hearings, issue orders, and adopt rules. Like I mentioned, you also have the power to close a school or a business if that's necessary for the health of the public. You also approve that 5-year community health improvement plan that I mentioned. So whereas they do the development of it, you all say, yep, we approve this, or, you know, you left out something big that's important to you all, and you know that maybe community residents have been telling you, we want to see this happen. And we, you know, we always want it to be based on information and data and those sorts of things, but you all really approve it. And then it does get submitted to the State Board of Health. The State Board of Health, they're great. They want you to do what's best for your community. They do review them, and so if there's something just, I don't know, nutty in one of the communities that they pick, they can say, we don't approve that. I've never seen that happen yet, because they really, again, see it as a partnership. Through the local public health director, local Board of Health accepts and administers the local, state, federal, and private funds, and then they certify demands against the public health funding to make sure that, basically, in the past, money was spent on other things besides public health. It happened very frequently. Well, especially when you talk about prevention and promotion, it's really easy, you know, especially, like, so my background is I'm a social worker by trade, so I used to work in child welfare, and it was so easy to get people to care about that. You know, you find a kid in the closet, this is awful, we need fun. Put more funding into protecting children. It's a person that you see happening. With public health, it's all this prevention, and I swear the return on investment, and it's hard for people to connect, right, that this is important to fund. Even though we know it saves money and it's the right thing, it's easier sometimes to fund those things that you can see, and it's just human nature because you see humans, right, and you want to protect people from some of these bad things. But what the Public Health Act did 10 years ago was to say, we know those other things are really important, and you can't spend public health money on other things besides public health things. So whenever you're looking at certifying the funding, thinking about it from the standpoint of, is this addressing, is this is this a direct service or is this addressing an entire population?
This will be certifying the funding that is comes from the state.
That comes from the state, absolutely. Yeah, you do with your funding what you... Yes, we're not trying to tell you how to use your funding, but the funding that comes from the state needs to be spent on... needs to be spent on public health things. And so asking yourself that question, how is this addressing the whole population? And I always show the exception to immunizations protect an entire population when you give a vaccine to one. So that appears more like a direct service, but it's actually protecting a population. So those are supported through our work as well. The duties of the treasurer, so the county treasurer, and I don't know if you want to talk about the joke that you said at the beginning. I don't know. Do you have a county treasurer? Like, that's good. Okay.
Yeah.
That's crazy. But making sure that, again.
Just leave it there.
I'm just kidding, sorry. But just creating that that fund that has, that makes sure that any appropriated money, a statute, around money that is appropriated from the county general fund for public health must be spent on public health. So that is a piece that's in there as well. And then money received from state or federal, any other gifts, grants, donations, must, if they're designated for public health, have to be spent on public health.
So explain to us how many districts there are in the state.
Well, there are 53 local public health agencies.
In county by county?
Some counties are joint, and it's all based on, to be really frank with you, especially in the rural areas, whether or not commissioners like each other. So, like, in the northeast area, there's six counties who, in 1948, they were buds, and they said, this doesn't make sense for us to have a public health director in every county.
So
let's work together.
Yes.
They pooled it.
Yeah.
So, but some commissioners are like, we don't want to regionalize. That's a really R, it's the R word. It's a bad thing to say. And they want to, and so we at the state say, you do how you want. It is a local controlled state. It's one of the things we love about our job. We don't want to, we're not coming in to tell you you need to share services with anybody.
We like that too.
Yes. And good.
So if you want to fund it all, you can tell us how the hell to do it.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. Maybe I'll, Yeah, so there are a few other places like Silver Thread. Have you heard of Silver Thread Health District? It's Mineral and Hinsdale. They formed a health district together because they found, and they're very different places, which
they're
is interesting.
Too.
Yeah. And yep. They said, this doesn't make sense to hire a health department director. But then when you go to, like, San Juan, Becky Joyce, she is the public health director for 700 people, even though San Juan Basin, which is close by, which is Archuleta and La Plata, you know, why not just add San Juan to that? You know, it might make sense for everyone. The county commissioner is like, no. You know, so it just depends on the feel of the community and what people want. And, again, we don't tell you how to do it. We just say, what can we do to help, you know, realize whatever you need, as long as it is addressing, you know,
the Tri-County one?
Yeah, Tri-County's a big one. Yeah, there's others, too. There's Otero Crowley work together.
Kiowa. And what the needs of the communities are, too. Because if you have two vastly different communities, maybe that's not a good fit for
absolutely
a program.
Or for the services and needs that each
exactly
one of them need to have.
Yeah.
Well,
and maybe it worked in the past,
and it doesn't.
You got to
keep
looking at that periodically to make sure that it still works.
It's a great point.
And if you go back to the opening slide, Anne-Marie talked about partnerships. I mean, that's another hybrid of this is partnering. We've got several public health partnerships that exist. They still have individual county agencies or individual directors, but they partner up and share services through these partnerships. And there's other versions where I worked at in Southeast Colorado as the Environmental Health Director. Each county had its own agency up until more recently when I was there, when Kiowa merged in through an agreement with Pryor's County. But we did environmental health services through intergovernmental agreements through the four counties altogether. So there's all sorts of hybrids on how this can be done. It's not there's this cookie cutter, it has to be rigidly exactly this
which
way
is
everywhere.
Good.
But the general framework that Anne-Marie sent out still exists in most of these places.
Yeah,
and that's what we're doing that through Northwest Colorado Health.
Yeah.
They're a multi county agency. Presumably they're leveraging these resources.
Other than they're a 501c3 versus being a
government entity, So the other thing I want to say, remember I talked about public health transformation, and we're going to take those two circles and combine them to create a framework. So the purpose of that is, if you ask us right now how much do core public health services in our state cost, we have no idea. We can tell you how much we give. I know. Can you believe it? So we can say... here's what we spend, here's how much money we give. How much does it actually, if we said, you guys have all the money to do what you needed to do, how much would that, we don't know that answer for any community in our whole, in the whole state. A couple have been trying to do that on their own to figure out what, how much do we really need. So we're trying to, we're doing a cost assessment.
Well, it seems like it wouldn't be that complicated. I mean, you know how much money the state is providing, and you should be able to look at each county's budget, see how much money they're
right
providing.
Right, but that, right.
We can't even tell how much we're putting in. We're,
yeah, we can.
No, we can't.
It hasn't been segregated.
We just goes in the whole bunch, we put in the whole money into the program.
Well, that's why we have
to not necessarily all public health.
Yeah, but different than what it costs.
That's the difference. So it, we can say how much we're spending, but how much would it actually cost if we did it well? Because we're not, like, there are some, the opioid crisis, I mean, there's so many things, public health emergencies and things that come up on a regular basis, and then you guys are asked, well, yeah, here, work on that. You know, sometimes the state has extra dollars or the feds come in and do, but a lot of times it's like, good luck with that. And so we're trying to say, how much do all the core services cost? And then we're also going to ask the questions to find out across our state, what is the most efficient and effective public health model in Colorado? Two other states have done this, actually more than two, but two have been really successful, and a third is successful, but they're not quite done. Kansas is still working on theirs, but Oregon and Washington have both just gone through this, figured out how much their core services cost, went to the legislature, said, we know how much it costs now. This is how much you give us. I mean, in the last 10 years, our population has increased 14%, and I think we've increased our amount to you all 1%. I mean, it's not fair, you know, and then we're asking, again, the unfunded mandate type stuff. So we're trying to figure out how do we rectify that. And so we're working with the same consultant that they worked with. So we already have an algorithm for how to do it, how to, you know, we're saving money on some of that because they've already done it. Both of them, I think they asked for $12 million in Washington. They got five, which I'm like, we'll take five. Like, you know, maybe it's not the full amount that we need, but it'd be nice to know the answers to some of these. And so when Keith talked about partnerships, partnerships are more, they're a little less formal. We're actually funding you guys to do some partnership work with both Moffitt and Jackson, because there's some natural, just geographical things that you guys are working on there. But that's not an official shared services where you're saying, okay, we're going to, you know, we'll take tobacco and do that. You guys do, you know, nurse home visitor or whatever those things are, so that you're really maximizing your resources instead of everyone trying to do it a little bit, you know. So I just wanted you to know that's coming down the pike. That's what transformation is about. And so I hope in 2020 we can tell you, you're getting more money so you can actually work on this and really.
So was that the outcome in both Oregon and Washington is just more money, or did they reprioritize what sort of services they wanted?
They did that. So
They did get more money.
They got more money and they reprioritized services. So it's both looking at, yes, we need more money to do this, but that's the last step. If you look at public health transformation and the different phases, and I'm happy to share that proposal with you guys. And that's actually the old version, though. It's way better than that. I'll send you the newer one.
And so in the meantime,
yes,
we need to be, you know, have a good understanding of what it costs to run an environmental health program and the funding that is coming in and what that difference is, so we can provide that information.
Yes, when we ask for it in April,
right,
or May.
And I think it's pretty obvious that it's grossly underfunded statewide.
Yes. Yes.
Anne Marie, can I ask?
Yeah, of course.
So you talked about some states have basically gone around and said, okay, where is it most effective and most efficient? How was that measured? How would the state, like, what would that look like, I guess?
So
what's the algorithm that says you're most efficient and you're most effective?
So that's a really good question. We're not on phase five yet. but I can show you the, and actually, can I see that for a second? I think that the visual might be in there. I'll send this. It's a really good question. And one of the phases, okay, it's not in this one yet. This is the old version. So one of the steps is creating a reporting structure for performance management and accountability. So it's not, and then messaging and increasing the fundings at the end was kind of my point. We're not,
yeah.
That's important, but it's not, that's what got us to have the conversation. But all this stuff that gets us there is really what's most important.
That has to happen first.
Yes, and so right now, we ask you to do an annual report, and to be honest, we don't get a lot from that. Like I couldn't even tell a lot from the annual report that you all submitted, just because the questions are very broad and people submit what they want, and we need to make sure that as a state that we're using taxpayer dollars well, right? That's one of our roles. So we need to get a better structure and system for, okay, with one of the core services. We're actually operationalizing it further. Right now in the Board of Health rules, like if you take, let's say emergency preparedness is one of them, there are probably 5 or 6 bullets under emergency preparedness. Those are very general if there's only 5 or 6 bullets. In the new version and what other states have done, there's like a 2 to 3 page with verbs about what does it mean to do emergency preparedness? What are those tasks? And once we have all those defined, then we can hold people more accountable to them. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, so it's just a huge looking piece to prepare and think about how do we evaluate and how do we prepare for that change. That
well, part. And being part of the steering committee, I know that was something that you considered doing. That would be awesome to apply for that. We're having there's going to be a steering committee that's going to steer this, that we're going to have county commissioners involved on it, and then local boards of health, or public health directors, of course, but then some other staff as well.
And they're also asking specifically for people in rural areas to sure that those areas are represented.
Absolutely. It's not going to be led by a bunch of, I mean, not that the people in the metro area aren't awesome, but it's not going to be led by metro
areas. Well, I guess our state has never been a one-size-fits-all.
No, never. And we appreciate that, and we want to keep that going, but we also want to say what we've been doing for the last 10 years is better than where we were, but we still haven't figured it out, and we have. And now that there are these other states who kind of led the way, we actually were the second state to pass a statute and have core services. So we were ahead. Then these other states learned from us. They did that, but then they've added more accountability, more reporting, which we didn't have. So now we're going, okay, that's cool you learned from us. Now we want to learn from you and try to move us a little bit further. So, so that's kind of where we're headed with it. So I think we're excited about it because we think it does support all kinds of communities. And we have a couple like Bobby and Montezuma. You know, her biggest question is, oh my gosh, am I going to have a job? Are you going to regionalize me? And we're like, no, that's not what this is about. It's about you figuring out. Now, let's say we do the study and we ask all the questions about efficiency and we figure out, Bobby, it probably makes sense for you and Mary to come together and for you guys to have one public health director serving both counties. That probably would be the most efficient, effective thing. You
very
just... Yeah, sorry.
Really
yes, very small town. So, you know, but that's them, that's for their commissioners and them to make a decision to decide, yes, we want to do that, or no, we're not ready right now. You know,
and that's maybe where we could use some direction from you guys if you want somebody like me or Carrie to serve on that steering committee and represent this part of the state, and we can talk about, I think the deadline's coming up pretty soon.
November 21st is it to apply for it. So I would venture to say just apply, and then you could, if they're like, whoever is in charge says, no, we don't want you to represent, or we don't want to be on that, we don't think it's a good use of time, you can always say no.
Right.
But I'd get your application thing, because I'm surprised at how many people, it's great, people are really invested from all over the state, so we're excited about it.
And we just want to make sure that we're represented.
Yeah, absolutely. And if... So we are looking at making sure every part of the state's represented, but we can't have 53 people on the group, right? Like it's so we're making sure in between those steering committee meetings, we're going back to the directors and to their staff and saying, okay, here's what we're looking at, like for each one of the core services to come up with all the verbs and like, okay, what does it mean to do emergency preparedness? What does it mean to do maternal and child health? Those are not being decided by the steering committee. The steering committee is helping make decisions, but in between, we're having anyone who's interested to, like, I'm an expert on maternal and child health, I care about the topic, come on, we want you to help us add, to make sure, does this reflect? The one thing I will say is this is all about the governmental public health system, as you mentioned, right, that a lot of people are doing great things in health in your community. Absolutely. So we're talking about what needs to be done by a governmental public health agency, like within our lane. And that's the frame we're using in developing this. So it doesn't get like too crazy. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Sorry, that's a lot of information.
Except we'd like to take credit for all of that and say we're done.
Yeah, right? and then involving the county attorney, anytime. That's just... Keith's always really good about ask your county attorney. Do you want to do this slide? I'd be like, you love this slide. Yeah, that is just important to keep your county attorney. Because we'll have people call us to ask some of the questions you actually asked of, you know, what are we required to do? And it says this. Does this mean X? You know, we can tell you kind of here's what we think, but we can't give advice on that because, you know, you have to do what's best for your county again. Okay, so... Yeah, so we have, it sounds like they already have all this stuff, but if, in case you, would you like a bound pocket of Public Health Act? We have extras if you want. Come on, it'll help you go to sleep tonight when you're tired and you can't sleep. The one other handout I did bring, have you, and I'm sure you guys have seen these, the pocket guides. Nope. This actually takes the statute and makes it really simple and a small. Oh, good. There's something that's useful. I'm happy. These are really great. And
do you want to see one? Here, just pass them around.
There's plenty. You get a pocket guide. You get a pocket guide. I'll never forget that Oprah episode. Okay, so this is the other thing, too, I just wanted to share. I don't know how public health accreditation, or if that's an important topic. Okay, I'm seeing nods. That's good. So these are the standards for public health accreditation by the National Public Health Accreditation Board. And I just thought I thought it would be a good this is really 2.0, 3.0 type of work. You don't have to. Like the state health department's been accredited. We have six other counties, public health agencies who are accredited. Why I share it is not to say you should go get accredited, not that I'm saying you shouldn't. I mean, it's something to consider. But it does kind of help break down those things that are really important and what the standards are for public health. So I just think it's another document that kind of highlights that it's different than direct care and really what are those things that we should be doing as a public educator.
This document ties real well with the transformation initiative.
Yeah.
These are the kind of principles that we get with that initiative.
Yeah. Yeah, and, public health, there is a document that I did not bring called Public Health 3.0 that really highlights kind of, in a long time ago, Public Health 1.0 was there's dirty water, we need to make sure people aren't sick, and we're working on that. Then it's gone into, tobacco cessation. We're working on making sure people stop smoking and doing some cessation programs, that sort of thing. 3.0 is really seeing public health as the term they're using is the chief health strategist. So how are our public health directors considered chief health strategists? Meaning they look across the whole community and think about how is transportation affecting health? How is housing affecting health? Who else in your community thinks about health from that global standpoint and brings the right players together to have the conversations that need to be had in order to keep people healthy. And so so a lot of the chief health strategist stuff's in here too, so it aligns really nicely. So it's just kind of a new way of thinking of public health than in the old way, So I just wanted to share that as well. I did not bring that paper, which I'm glad because you guys didn't really need much of this, but I can share the link if you're interested. Thanks. Yeah. So that's it. That's all we have. Do you have questions? Was this helpful?
Yeah, what's the last
do you want to go to sleep?
A community health plan.
We're in the midst of one right now.
Would this be the first time that we've done a community?
No, we did.
2007? Okay.
2007.
Yeah, we are in the midst of developing the priorities right now.
And we kicked it off in 2017. And I think the last plan was good through 2016, and then you begin the process of developing a new plan.
So it's like a 10-year plan?
I think it's five.
It's 5 years. And the one
unless
thing,
you kick it down.
The one thing I will say and is that there are public health agencies who do their plans, and it says all the right stuff, and they're excited, but they're not doing any of it.
It
sits on the shelf, and there's no implementation of it. And so the one thing I would do, and not that I think that would happen at all with you in the helm, Carrie, but just knowing that it's really important, whatever comes out in that, to hold the public health director accountable for those things, because that's the purpose of it, right? And we've heard from a lot of the commissioners and the folks that we visited around the state that sometimes that gets gets missed. Like, this is beautiful, looks great, you're not implementing it, and that's the whole purpose of it, is to make sure that the implementation is there.
Resources to do it.
Exactly, and that's actually a good point. We talk about when you develop your plan, think about the resources you actually have. So sometimes some areas will pick, something in every core service. You're not required to have a plan that addresses every core service. You're required to have a plan that is going to meet the needs of your community with the funding that you have available to you. So I wish I would have brought it. Alamosa, the San Luis Valley, their assessment, have you guys seen it? They just said it's this size. There are pictures in there, like to show, like not of photos, but it's like an infographic, right, with information on the topic areas. It tells you kind of important things at the bottom, and then it's here's what we're going to do, and it's like people will actually read it, and it's going to be really useful to them because it's they did a lot of work, but the product is something that people might actually want to look at. I mean, that's the idea. We're actually for the state plan. We also are required to do a statewide assessment plan, and ours is we're in the process of finishing our assessment, which we use all of your information and data to help inform it, of course, and we come up with priorities and then things that we'll work on. One of our products this next time are going to be murals around the state. And actually, if you guys know artists, we might want to do one up here. We're trying to find artists from communities across the state that will create a mural based on what they see and learn in the to try to connect some of these other sectors with health.
To be placed where?
In your community. Yeah, okay. Wherever you want. So the idea is that we are connecting something that people see as and I don't like this, right? This is what the state does. This is the kind of stuff we do. No one like who wants to read this? Who wants? We got to stop doing that if we want community members. Do I?
It's an eye catcher.
Yeah, right. Seriously. So how do we make sure that the information we have, the implementation strategies we have that are meaningful and relevant, and we use plain words to convey that to people. So if you asked your neighbor, do you know what Colorado's focusing on around health? They'd say, oh yeah, I've seen, they would know about it. It'd be on social media or somewhere, and people would take an interest in it, rather than it just being this thing that sits on the shelf. So I encourage you to be creative with your end product and how you share it with community members, because it really shouldn't be something that just government officials talk about and then it just kind of sits there. So we're really trying to change the way we do things. So anyway.
Well, a lot of this ties into the way the Public Health Act was written was very much local control. You assess and you determine what your community needs and you plan for that, which would include resources. And so it's your decision to do what are these core services and how does it work within the funding, or even though the public health agency may not do it in the way the statute's written, it can be, or you are sure that it's being done in some way by some other entity within the community. But you determine what the priorities are, what's mm-hmm. important for your community. Yes, there are core services that need, someone brought up vital statistics. I mean, there's some things that are required to be done or that they're assured to be done. But most of it, it's a local decision on what you do. And you're also not limited. That's part of what that infographic the public health transformation, it really hits home that you can take these buckets and make them as deep as you want, but for your own local resources and your own local mm-hmm. prioritization. You want to make that bucket as deep as you want. I mean, the Act may say, well, you need to go here, but locally you may say, well, no, we want to take this real deep.
Yeah.
And then you can use your own resources and funding streams to do that however you wish.
Yeah.
So when will we see that community health plan?
Our goal is by the summer to have it finished.
This December?
So no, what's the process?
This summer, I'm sorry.
This summer. I mean, there's phases that you go through, and we have a lot of community partners that are involved in it. Scott and Kelly, we have...
Tim went to one meeting in the
evening. Yeah, you went to
one. That was kind of the kickoff meeting, wasn't it?
I don't think so. Well, it was one of the early meetings, though.
Yeah,
and so as we go through, we do the prioritization of the community members, what they think is important, and we are doing a regional plan, so just so you're aware of that, it includes Jackson and Moffitt counties as well. So then we'll identify the prioritization of the issues, and then from that we'll compile all the data, take a look at that, have it inform the process, and then we'll create basically an output which you'll read through and see and improve.
Maybe you should check in with us before you get to the finish line.
For
see
sure.
Where you're at.
That would be a good idea.
Yeah.
And I hate to run the veto pen, but,
Yes. Yeah. So right now,
it's definitely a good topic for our quarterly meeting.
Yeah. Yep. And right now, mental wellness of children and families is one of the priority issues that the team has decided has surfaced, and then additional physical security. So just making sure that we have the tie-in with environmental health and some other concerns have surfaced. So.
And those mirror what we're hearing at the state, too. that, like, across the state, the mental health, behavioral health stuff is just huge, you know. And to think of it different from human services, like, human services does treatment. Public health does promotion and prevention. And I know I keep saying it, and you guys are like, yes, I know, but I just have to keep saying it, because there is confusion sometimes with behavioral health at the state, even with human services and us. Like, well, wait, we're both, you know, there's a gray area, we kind of work together, but really we work more upstream, and they are doing more treatment of individuals who are already addicted to opioids. Let's say we're trying to help the doctors stop prescribing, or, you know, get it before it even becomes an issue. So anyways, not that that's necessarily your focus, but yeah. Yeah, so any other questions? Or
just maybe a comment more than a question. I mean, this is very helpful. All this information, you know, helps me understand better what my responsibilities are. I guess the only concern I have is that a lot of this seems to be focused on process rather than outcomes. You know, you kind of understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
When you go through this whole thing and check all these boxes and say, yep, we're
yep.
responsibilities, and lose sight of, well, what are we really trying to accomplish in the end here?
And
not get too hung up on those processes. If we can come up with the good outcomes using a different model, I'd like to think we'd have some flexibility there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that the outcomes will be driven by what your community assessment is. So once you come up with those priorities, so let's say it's mental health, you'll look at what are those health outcomes you want to see change. You'll set a target or a goal for what those are, and then that's something that you can monitor. You could have a scorecard or a dashboard or whatever you guys will do to say, okay, here's the things we want to see change. I will say with public health, you know, it takes years, like if you look at tobacco or seatbelts or any of these, some of the most successful things that we've done in public health, they take years. It's a culture change a lot of times, although you can still measure that. But it's not necessarily, I think a lot of, it'd be nice if you could say, oh, here's a grant for changing something upstream in your community, but it doesn't happen just in a year. That culture change takes time, and so that's the thing that kind of makes it hard. But you can still measure those things for sure. And that's where I would say your outcomes would be. We have lots of data and state outcomes that you can compare yourself to, but we don't set, you must do the following in your community and achieve X outcome, because we're trying to give the flexibility. Does that make sense?
But that's what the Act allows for. Every 5 years, you look at it. 5 years is the time frame that you can see some
change. Yeah, for sure.
So yeah, the outcomes are in the process does generate outcomes. That's part of the way this was written, the way it was to generate outcomes through the assessment. It's not just the assessment. There's planning, there's implementation, there's monitoring, it's a whole cycle. And then you start over again. You've gone through the phase, and then you determine what happened, and you start your assessment process over again, take what you've learned, and maybe this doesn't need to be looked at anymore. That's been addressed sufficiently, so you find another project. Or it hasn't been addressed enough, and so you find out different ways to continue to generate additional outcomes through it. So it doesn't say outcomes in here, but that's what the assessment planning and public health improvement plan process is for outcomes.
And if you're interested in your specific data or information on specific topics for your area, well, how are we doing on that? I mean, of course, you can always ask these guys, but we also have a person on our team whose job it is to, and it's all on our website. You can get there and look at like a profile of your county and learn kind of where you are. And so she's always available to chat, but I know you already work with her, so you can go through Carrie as well. But to really look at, to dig in, because sometimes you're like, okay, I know this, but I want to know this. You know, we can help kind of get there. So, yeah.
The other part of your question. You all can use whatever of your own resources you want for whatever programs you want to improve the health of your community, whatever way you see fit. It's just that the public health funds that are as defined in the statute have to be used within.
Right.
They're pretty wide guardrails, but there's still some guardrails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I don't have any other questions.
Thank you for your
time. Good. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Well, it's great meeting you all. Thanks.
Do you guys have any thoughts on this?
Not right now. No.
Okay. So I guess
go ahead and put your application in, and then we'll tell you whether or not we want you to do it.
I don't forget.
And then yeah. I guess we'll talk more.
I don't know if I can see myself.
So we're here for our 2:30 agenda item, a public hearing regarding the Steamboat Springs Area Fire Protection District proposed inclusion of property, and we're actually going to be having discussion and deliberation on both that inclusion or request for exclusion, as well as a discussion of regarding the question of a material modification of the existing service plan. So we do have a couple. We sent out our agenda packet earlier and asked that we keep the presentations somewhat manageable format. We're going to start off with our format being the district will present its position and hopefully utilize less than 15 minutes through that process. The property owners, we've asked that one person be a spokesman for that process, and that the property owner's position as to those exclusions be presented. And then the district will present its position as to whether or not the proposed inclusion amounts to a material modification of the service plan. And then number four, the property owner's position as to the material modification. So again, the district will present, and then the property owners will present their position on the material modification. And then both of those two presentations, 10 minutes each if we can. And then we'll have an opportunity, the commissioners will have opportunity to ask questions and then deliberate and provide some type of direction and or motion or and or yes, direction on that. So with that, I guess the other thing I would mention that for the purposes of this hearing, I actually am a property owner in the city, and it's subject to the district's proposal for inclusion. I received a notice of the property owner opportunity for exclusion. I did not file a petition for to be excluded from the district, and I believe that I can I present a non-biased opinion regarding the filing of the petitions as well as the material modification, and will be fair and impartial as I can in whatever, so in rendering my decision before this board today. So
and I'll say the same thing, that I own several residential parcels within the city of Steamboat Springs. I did not file a petition for exclusion, and I can act in an unbiased way today as well.
I don't own any property in the city. Doug, I think you talked about the 10 minutes each.
Yep.
For the folks to present their positions on the material modification. I don't think you mentioned 15 minutes each for
yes,
the request for the exclusion and 15 minutes for the...
I started off with that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay, and Commissioner Bogger has asked me to
be the timekeeper.
I'm going to be the timekeeper on that, so we're gonna, I think the idea was we're going to try to strictly enforce those time limitations. I'll wave 1 minute a finger when you're down to 1 minute.
And then the other thing, I guess, for the record, too, is that this is the packet for today. This is all of the notices for a request for exclusion in the inclusion request, as well as the information that was presented by both the fire department's council, as well as the opposition letters that were presented to us by Attorney Weiss and Tom Sharp representing himself. So we have all those. We also have all the minutes that were provided to us. We've been through all of those and read all those minutes as well prior to some good reading, especially since the Broncos didn't have to lose this week. So we'll start off. The position as to the request, so the district's position on the request for the exclusions. And if you could, please introduce yourself, too.
Is the mic on?
Yep, or you need to turn it on. Is it?
You did. Okay, so it's recording and we're all good to go.
My name is Dino Ross, and I am the general counsel for the Steamboat Springs Area Fire Protection District, and they've asked me to provide the statements on behalf of the Fire District Board of Directors today. My comments in this first section, as set out in the agenda, will be limited just to the exclusion request. And first, I'd like to say thank you all for taking the referral. We appreciate that, and we appreciate the county commissioner's willingness to assist in this process, so thank you. I think it's important to frame this first discussion of what is being asked.
You might move that mic over towards you a little bit more. That would be better. Yeah.
Being asked of the Board of County Commissioners in this first section. Under the statute, the Fire Protection District is responsible for all aspects of the inclusion process. It holds a public hearing on its potential moving forward with an inclusion. It adopts a resolution calling for that inclusion. It then submits that to the district court to see if the court will order an election on the inclusion. The district court then issues an order. It goes back to the Fire Protection District to run an election. None of that involves the county commissioners. What we have is a notice provision, as you saw in the letter notice that went out, that says that we need to advise citizens within the city, if they wish to petition for exclusion, that they should submit petitions. And it cross-references to a completely different section of the statute and says that you should submit that to the Board of County Commissioners. We've always read that really that's just a shorthand way of providing an exclusion process and really could be handled by the Fire Protection District. However, we certainly have had citizen concerns that, well, the statute says Board of County Commissioners, you really should send it to them. And our board said, fine, you know, let's do it in as open and transparent a process as possible. And so we have referred that to you all for that very narrow question of whether any of the properties within the city of Steamboat Springs should actually be excluded from the inclusion process. So it's very important, I believe, for the county commissioners to stay focused on, in this piece of it, the very special and narrow mandate of the statute. The standard is, why is it not in the best interest of the fire district, not the property owners, not the county, not the city, what is in the best interest of the fire district to exclude from the inclusion process those properties? So in other words, that's the standard, is what's in the best interest of the fire district. It's not asking you what's in the best interest of property owners in this process. Now, there's an election where the citizens will get to decide what's in the best interest of all citizens, but that's not the standard for this piece of this process. I've reviewed Mr. Weiss's November 7th letter. It reflects a lot of concerns that were raised by other members of the community in the public hearings that we've had. And he certainly will speak to all of those concerns. I know that he believes that the city council hasn't spent enough time on this in analyzing it. He thinks that including the properties certainly will subject them to a property tax, and that's not a good thing. He believes the fire district board is not accountable in the same way as the city council. He believes that the fire district board's assuming the responsibility for providing the emergency services is a fundamental change. And that, you know, there's other options. Well, that all may be true, but that's not the standard that you're looking at. Your standard is whether exclusion is in the best interest of the fire district. Those issues are what the electors decide. The statute does not authorize the commissioners to determine whether including the property within the city into the district is a good or a bad idea. That's not in the statute. It also doesn't ask the county commissioners to decide whether consensus building is a better process than an election. And it certainly doesn't authorize the county commissioners to do a wholesale exclusion of all of the city area as a way of simply killing the project. One of the things that we have done is submitted a position statement, which the county commissioners have. In section 3A of that position statement, we set forth a number of reasons why we believe that excluding any of the area from the inclusion process is not in the best interest of the fire district. But what I'd like to do is reserve some time now for the fire chief to talk to you about that. And Chief Stewart, if you could come up, that would be great.
Okay. Mel Stewart, I'm the fire chief for Steamboat Springs. It's a city department that provides service to both the city and the surrounding area and the district. I'm just going to speak to you from an operational standpoint and from really, I guess, more of a layman standpoint. When I read the exclusion option, I read it, and the way I read that is if someone that owns property that's in either the city or the district is in a position to where we physically, our department physically could not provide services to them, then I would view that as being a reasonable argument to say, look, I want to be excluded from you taxing me. I don't want you to tax me for something that you can't provide to me. And, you know, I thought about this a lot more. It's like, well, and I've read some of the legal arguments, and I'm not a legal expert by any means, and I can grasp some of the reasoning behind the legal arguments. From an operational and a practical standpoint, if I go down the road of saying, well, legally we can allow this building to be excluded from the process. Well, what does that mean if we take it a little further? Does that mean that we somehow mark the building and say these people or this property owner hasn't paid into the fire district and thus we won't respond to that property for a medical or a fire? I mean, it just doesn't even seem feasible. Does that really happen? It does. It has happened, and if you go way back in fire history, Benjamin Franklin started a fire company in Philadelphia, and you subscribe to that fire department and pay a service fee, and then if you had a fire or an emergency there, they responded to that property. If the neighbor didn't subscribe, they didn't respond. And you're like, well, okay, well, that was back in the 1700s, and that doesn't happen today. I remember reading a news article a few years ago, actually it was in 2010, where this exact thing happened in Tennessee. They had a subscription service, and this person didn't subscribe. Their house caught on fire. The fire department responded, and they sat and watched the house burn to the ground. They put water on the fence, protected the neighbor's house who had paid their subscription fee, but didn't do anything to put that house out. Of course, the homeowner was upset. The fire department was like, "Hey, you could have paid at the time," and then I think there was even some offers to pay them when they showed up. I just can't even imagine that scenario. And I would hope that we don't get into some sort of scenario like that. But again, I'll go back to what I originally saying. When I read it from a layman's terms, if you ask my opinion, someone can make an argument and say, can you respond to our property? And I look at them and I say, no, we can't get there. It's just impossible for us to be able to respond to your property. Then, yeah, I think that would make sense to exclude it. So that was my operational. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have any time?
I think the chief has eloquently kind of laid out the issue. I'm going to belabor it just a second in legal terms. First off, if we do the pre-inclusion agreement as planned between the city and the district, and we exclude the areas, include all of the city area except for some excluded properties, what we will have is the district is the sole emergency service responder. It has jurisdictional area, and we will have a charter buried in the middle. Now, this is not on the side. This is in the middle. As you all know, Steamboat Springs City is in the middle of the district, 384 square miles, and you're a 10 square mile area in that. It is buried in the center, and you will have a checkerboard of houses or commercial properties sitting there somewhere within that that aren't paying, that aren't part of the jurisdiction, that the district has no service responsibility to. And quite frankly, what do? Have them paint the house a different color, put up a badge that says, hey, we decided not to be part of your district, because when this happens, all of the emergency service responsibilities shift from the city to the district. The city isn't going to have a separate municipal department. The other thing that it doesn't do is it doesn't allow for the district to have uniform and unified emergency response within a jurisdictional area. And those that provide those services know how critical that is. You have to be able to pre-plan. You have to be able to provide that service in a unified way across a homogeneous area, and this would defeat that purpose. So it really disrupts operations. The other thing that it does is it doesn't allow fire district to have fire code enforcement authority. You could build something on one of those properties. We wouldn't have any ability to enforce a fire code. It could be a fire hazard. And forget that it poses a problem just to that district, to that property. It poses a fire hazard to all the surrounding properties that are in our jurisdiction. It makes no sense. So we would ask that the board not exclude any of these properties. What should happen is this should go to an election for the entire area, and we shouldn't piecemeal this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Who's speaking on behalf of the
questions now and later?
I think we'll ask later.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll some of my air out.
Okay.
Bob, so you?
Me. Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, thank you very much for offering me this opportunity to speak to this very important issue this afternoon. Just to put it on the record, I represent several petitioning property owners, but certainly not all of them. By the way, was there any effort made to give notice to people that petition that may not be represented by me, that so they knew this hearing was occurred? Was there a mailing done?
No mailing, just a public notice.
Just the normal public notice. Okay. So I think at the outset, it's important to kind of frame this as Mr. Ross did as well. Why this has gotten the attention of so many people and why you had so many petitions filed with you concerning this is because this is the biggest tax increase in the history of Brown County. And I've been saying that now for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and there have been numerous hearings, and no one has dispute that. So when I first started saying, I was being a little equivocal, and I said this appears to be the biggest tax increase. Now I'm going to say it is the biggest tax increase, $6 million annually within the city ever in the history of Brown County. And it's also, in my view and the view of many others, the most dramatic change in the way a crucial service is delivered to the community in a very long time. So those two factors, an enormous tax increase, a fundamental change in which a core service of government is limited, is delivered to the community. So that's why this has generated as much interest as it has. And that's why those of us, and I was intimately involved in when those letters came out that you, some of the commissioners received announcing this plan, and the letter said you could file a petition. Why we put the petitions together, and a lot of us got together. We sent them out to everybody we knew. It was a very short time frame, and there was very little argument with anyone about, is this a good idea or a bad idea? People really respond to those, and that's why you got so many as you did, because there was a serious question about those two fundamental issues: change in the way fundamental government services are delivered, the size of the tax increase involved. Now, I'm going to be candid. When I listen to the chief, I think his argument's pretty persuasive on this question of inclusion and exclusion. In other words, some of these are condos. Okay, so imagine the scenario where the condominium building catches on fire and one condo is excluded, but the rest of the building is included. Then the fire department's not going to put the building out. That's a kind of a preposterous situation. So it's a very important thing to keep in mind what we are requesting here, and it's in my letter, and I want to emphasize it. And that's in the last paragraph. The statute says, it's real clear, that you can receive petitions for exclusion, but that does, and I'm going to quote this, the Board of County Commissioners should not be limited in its action with respect to inclusion of territory based upon a request. Okay. The only reasonable reading of that is you can exclude the people that have petitioned, and you can exclude anything else in your judgment that should be excluded. So our request to you is to exclude the entire city from this process, not just the petitioners, the entire city. And I agree with the chief, a piecemeal exclusion doesn't make any sense. We're not proposing that. We're proposing you to look at your statutory authority. The Board of County Commissioners should not be limited in its action with respect to an exclusion of territory based upon a request. We think that means you can exclude the entire city. Now, I'm sure, and I knew one of the difficult arguments here was going to be Mr. Ross, I think, makes his point, which we're arguing a lot of substantive things, which the argument's going to be, although it's going to be determined at the election, it's going to an election. We've been listening now for a month longer to the very serious concern expressed by the fire department over the level of service they're able to deliver in the community. They're saying they're getting double, triple, and quadruple calls for EMS services, that it risks endangering lives. They have to have increased personnel and equipment in a new station. They've been emphatic on that. I think all the people I represent, the community generally realizes the city has a problem. It needs to be addressed. And we all have an obligation to make that happen. Everybody agrees on that. No one's disputing what the chief says. We need to relook at our fire and EMS service in this community and make sure it's adequate to serve the community properly and protect the public. So, what's the best way to do that? Our view is the best way to do that is to develop a consensus plan. But that is not what has happened here. I looked at every video where this has discussed. You know, it's a modern miracle these days. I've looked at every video that was discussed, where this issue was discussed by the city council starting in May when Mr. Ross made his initial presentation to the council and said, we've got this pre-inclusion agreement, we got this plan, and the plan is we're going to turn the fire department over from the city to the district. We're going to put on our existing mill levy that was voted in the donut around the city, the fire district, not by the city residents. On the city, we're going to have an election and mud season in May. We're going to cash fund the new fire station. And that's the plan. And that plan was developed without any participation of commercial property owners, in the community that are going to pay half the bill. So there's $6 million property tax, roughly speaking, because of Gallagher, the way it works, commercial property owners pay about half the bill within the city of Sequoia Springs for property tax increases. So we've got an 18% property tax increase across the board. We've got a district that will now constitute 80% of the assessed value of Brown County, 80%. And we don't have any kind of a consensus plan to make this happen, and we don't really have a serious effort to achieve a consensus plan. We have a plan that was developed in a process over this last summer where I've listened to every video. There was not one single public comment the entire time. Not one comment in six meetings. So, what does best interest of the district mean, quote unquote? Pretty broad standard, best interest of the district. We think best interest of the district means developing a consensus plan and getting the past. And that's not happened. So we think it is contrary to the best interest of the district, the city, the public, the taxpayers, the fire department, everybody involved to proceed with this plan. Because there has not been a serious effort to develop a consensus. And when you look at a broad statutory standard like that, we think that is within your discretion to look at all that. Now, it would make sense to me, and I can understand, you certainly don't want to preclude the city or the district from kind of proceeding with their process, and I could understand that. But it seems to me the statute and the fact that you, the county, formed this district originally, it couldn't exist, you gave birth to it by approving the service plan, have some residual obligation to make sure this works. And so what we are asking you to do is to exclude this property, the entirety of the city. That'll cause this process to pause and send the parties back to the drawing board to come up with a plan that is likely to pass and likely to find a solution for this important community issue. We think you're kind of the check and balance on this, and the statute has given you that authority. I was thinking about how else to analogize this. Kind of like the House of Lords in England. You know, they can't stop legislation, but they can make sure that people think about it a lot. And that's what we're asking you to do. We're not asking you to substitute your judgment for the city or anybody else. We're asking you to look at your statutory rights, the fact that you formed this district in the first place, and to try to cool things off so that a consensus plan is developed that has a likelihood of success and that the community can buy into it. And we think that's the best way to do it. And I'm going to make a lot of the same arguments with respect to the service plan amendment, which is similar issues. And Tom, in his submittal to you, has made a lot of those same arguments. We just think that the process that's ongoing now is not in anybody's best interest, including the district. And we'd really think you have an opportunity to discharge your statutory duty and make it better. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So, what's our pleasure? Are we going
to? I have to say, we move on to the 10 minutes, and then come back for questions and deliberations as we have outlined in the agenda.
That sounds good. Super awesome. Talking about the material modification.
Thank you. We are now moving on to the second issue that was referred by the Fire Protection District to the commissioners. That is whether or not the Board of County Commissioners should determine that the proposed inclusion of the property would constitute a material modification to its October 2015 amended service plan. A couple things to note. The statute, first off, has a section, which is what we're working under, which is 32.1.207, subsection 2B, and actually 2A. And what it says, first off, is that actions taken necessary to perform a service plan in and of themselves do not constitute a material modification, nor do changes in the boundary. That's the fundamental bedrock starting place, right? Us doing what's provided for under our service plan and us including property does not, as a matter of statutory law, constitute a change or a material modification to the service plan. Approval of modification shall not be required for changes necessarily only for the execution of the service plan or for changes in the boundary of the special district. The only reason this issue is before you is because it contains an exception. If, in fact, the district is seeking to include an area that is in a municipality, in this case, that it hasn't provided service within its jurisdictional boundary before, it's to give you notice that, hey, we're thinking about doing this. And do you think that that constitutes an amendment to that? And then you have the discretion to figure out whether or not you think that's an amendment. That an amendment to the service plan is necessary. So let's kind of keep the context. First off, this is an exception to the fundamental rule, and as an exception, should be applied narrowly. The service plan, our October 2015 service plan, there is no dispute about the scope of what's put in there. We have full authority to exercise all the statutory rights and authority under the Special District Act, which means we can include property, expand our boundaries. We can provide all of the services that a fire protection district can provide, which is fire suppression, fire protection, public education, and emergency rescue, extrication, hazardous materials, ambulance, and medical services. Set forth in the service plan. There is not a single thing you need to amend in that service plan to include this property. It's already provided for there. The argument that's being made is that somehow this is a material change, a fundamental change in how we do business. And that's just not right. We have included with the submittals voluminous documents. Quite frankly, those are just examples of the monthly attorney's fire chief's reports that are submitted to our fire district, as well as minutes from each of the years going back to 2011. As you've indicated, you've read through those. They show an extraordinary level of involvement in all of the emergency services that are provided by Steamboat Springs Fire Rescue. Now, what is that? Steamboat Springs Fire Rescue. That is a combination joint partnership endeavor. If you look at the 2009 intergovernmental agreement between the city and the district, it makes it very clear this is a partnership. It's not us as some silent partner in the back writing a check once a month. We are an equal co-partner in the running of that department. We have been since the very beginning. We always have provided our emergency rescue services and ambulance services. Despite some of the comments that have been made, we do provide and have always provided fire. We purchase fire apparatus, brush trucks, engines, and we oversee the deployment of those. And remember, we're doing all this in the district to begin with. But we don't distinguish them. We also do it within the city. Our chief comes every meeting. Our board extensively discusses all aspects of the operation of that department. We develop a joint budget and work through it with the chief. We talk about emergency operation plans. We talk about fire. We do every single thing that the city does in the operating department. And we've been doing it for years. So there really is no material modification to this service plan. What we have is simply a shift of emphasis as to which governing body the chief is going to be reporting to and personnel are going to be employed by. What we really have in the arguments that we've seen is, once again, an argument to have you replace your judgment with the judgment of the city and the district board. What the opposition would like you to do is determine this isn't a good idea. But that's really not what's going on here. What we're asking is that this go to the citizens for an election. They should decide. And it shouldn't be sidetracked through the auspices of requiring a material modification. The other, I guess, final point on it is kind of putting the cart before the horse. We don't even know if we'll get a successful election. It would make no sense to amend a service plan now when we don't know if we'll ever get a successful election. That makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, what are you going to do? Have us amend and submit a service plan that may never come into play? Why would you do that? It makes no sense. And if we were to include property, there's nothing in that service plan that would need to be amended. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. So, Bob, are you going to lead off this conversation? Or?
Yes.
And then we'll take Tom Sharp off.
Bob Weiss again. What Tom and I discussed was, because he's not present in the room, he thought it would be easier for me to lead off here, but I think he'll jump in if he has something to add, if that would be all right, Mr. Chairman.
That sounds fine. Yep. Okay.
Tom has done what I think is an excellent job setting forth his reasoning for a need for a service plan amendment before this plan can proceed. He has, as he indicates in his letter, a lot of experience with service plan amendments in the county, that actually several that have been approved previously by the county and one that was rejected previously in the county when it came to the commissioners. So he has a real good feel about what the past practices of the county have been with respect to this issue and what the state law requires. So I would certainly not want to infringe too much on his turf here, but I'll do my best to see if I can summarize some of the arguments. Taking a look at his letter, which you have in your materials, the essential language that he cites to you is that what's being proposed here, this is for the reasons I indicated earlier, the size of the tax increase, the fact that the service now being provided by the city to this entire area is going to be provided by a special district. Whether or not that is, and all the other things that accompany this, whether that is a change of a basic or essential nature, that's the language in the statute, and he has cited that to you. And for all the reasons in both my letter and his letter, we think that it is. It is a change of a basic or essential nature, and it requires a service plan amendment before it can proceed. And why is that? Mr. Ross suggests that, in fact, the way things operate, that the district more is sort of de facto operating the city fire department. That just doesn't happen. I've got here, which I'll pass out, the budget of the district. Am I getting picked up here?
No, you need to get back to your mic.
Yeah. I'll pass it down.
The budget of the district and the budget of the city for five. And you'll see there, I believe it was the 2017 or 18 budget of the district, I put a green line through. That's the part I wanted to highlight. What the, what the district does is collects property tax revenues, delivers them to the city, and it says that in their budget. There's no personnel listed there, no employees. It's a pass-through arrangement where the city, where the district collects property taxes, turns it over to the city provides the service. The city hires the fire chief. All the firemen and other personnel are city employees. They operate under city personnel rules. That's what occurs. On the other hand, I've also given you the excerpt of the city budget, which shows how the city describes what it is doing. As you can see, all those employees are city employees. It's the city that operates the fire district, the fire department. And so what's being proposed here is what I, when I started out my earlier presentation, and this 9 mil property tax would change fundamentally how government service is being delivered, to raise taxes substantially, and all the other things that are associated with this. And that proposal, we think, is nowhere to be found in the 2015 service plan, neither the finances or the proposal itself. It just isn't there. Now, there's some language that says, oh, we can do whatever we want. It's kind of a generic service plan, but it doesn't talk about this proposal. And we think, for the same reasons that we think you should exclude all the city property from this proposal, that you should demand now, before this goes to an election, that there be a service plan amendment. Yes, sir.
5 minutes.
Five. And we think that will have the same beneficial effects that our earlier proposal was. It's going to generate the conversation in the community of the consideration of the options available, because when this service plan is submitted to you, there will be a discussion. What are the options? Is there another way to do this? Can we take the $1.8 million that the city's saving and apply that? The city's saving $1.8 million by offloading the fire department and sales tax revenue. Could we apply that against the cost of fire and reduce the mill levy by a third? That, I asked Kim Weber that last night. That hasn't even been on the table. It's an obvious way to keep this tax down, but it hasn't been discussed. Can we do a bond issue to build this fire station? It hasn't been discussed. So we think that you can, acting as the House of Lords, I don't want to make that analogy too often, but one more time, you can cause there to be a better process, and we think that you should try to do that, and that it's in the interest of your constituents, who are the people in the fire district, and by the way, and sometimes people forget this, the people within the city as well, our county residents. And so we are very hopeful that you will do one of two things, or both: exclude this property from the inclusion, being all of the property in the city, and require that there be a service plan amendment before this process goes any further and goes to a vote. By the way, the last thing I want to say is the resolution that was provided to you seems to say that this, the service plan modification could occur after the vote. That makes no sense. If there's going to be a service plan modification, unless it's just going to be window dressing, it needs to occur before the vote, because that's when there's an opportunity to develop a consensus plan, which we think is in the best interest of the district and the community. Thank you very much.
Hey, Tom. It's Carrie. Can you hear me? So take
yes,
your.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, and so just make sure that you're off speaker as well. And I think you probably have, what, about 3 minutes left?
Yeah.
We can hear you.
That's fine. Am I? Are you ready for me?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman and commissioners, thank you for letting me do this remotely. I very much appreciate that. Bob, I think, had summarized some critical components of my memo, pointing out that the statute, Section 207-2A, refers to the necessity for a modification when there is an addition to the type of services provided. That's actually provided. That's not theoretically provided. And the actual services that are being provided in the nature of fire rescue are all being provided by the city. So that physically, you know, the employees, the real property, most of the fire trucks and the like are all owned by the city and operated by the city. I want to cover real quickly the first sentence, which says that if a modification is required, it is to be approved by the county commissioners, quote, in substantially the same manner as is provided for the approval of an original service plan. When you look back at the procedure under the Special District Control Act, you'll see in the formation of district, you'll see that the original process mandates that the approval resolution must be supplied to the district court at the time of seeking a order ordering the election. In other words, it must be done before the election. I believe that wording in the statute means that a modification that is going to seek an amendment, seek a voter approval, must be approved before the election. And that's actually the way the county operated when it allowed the Steamboat 2 district to become a metropolitan district to take on road functions and provide for a approval of a modification of a service plan before it was submitted to the voters. That's what happened in the Treehouse district when it became a metropolitan district. That's the way the county proceeded with the Mount Warner Water Sand District when we saw it become a metro district with recreation power involving the issue of a golf course south of town and all the politics that were involved at that time. And in fact, the county commissioners voted 2-1 to oppose that modification and kibosh the change in the district's services without it ever getting to a vote. And I think that's what the statute requires. And the notion that it theoretically makes more sense to be amended after a vote is inconsistent with how a district is formed and inconsistent with this wording. So I think that if you choose to find that the type of service actually being provided is being materially modified by switching it all over from the city to the district, that you need to have that modification be heard before the election, not after. And I thank you very much, and I'll be listening in case you have any questions.
Thank you, John.
Yep, thank you.
Mr. Commissioner, the Chief had a couple comments he was hoping to make, and I suspect I have a few minutes left of my time. If you permit me.
You did have a couple, 3 minutes left.
Thank you.
Mel Stewart, Steamboat Springs Fire Chief. There's a couple of things that I want to, one, provide you with some information in relation to what Mr. Weiss presented to you. I'm talking about the City Council in the Fire District, have been talking for several years, and specifically for about the last year, of how do we move forward on being able to fund the fire department with the increasing needs for services. Two council members and two district board members, along with staff, have been meeting to flesh out the best way to move forward, and that's been going on for months. And so that's what's brought us to this point today of looking at an election coming up in May. So this has been worked on, bringing a lot of expertise to the table to figure the best way forward. So I just wanted to provide that a little bit of background, and I appreciate Mr. Weiss's comments on, how do we determine if there's been one property that's not paid into this? If we excluded one, you've got to do them all. It seems like that's the only logical way to go. The one thing that I contradict him is he says the way Forest Services are delivered are being changed. And I'll contradict that. It's not the way Forest Services are going to be delivered. It's the way the Forest Services are going to be funded. The way the Forest Services are funded today is through sales tax from the city and property tax from the district. And if this were to move forward and be a successful election, it would be property tax from the whole area, which the district would then include the city. All the same people, the trucks, the stations, all of those core things that are being used to deliver those services are still going to be delivering those services from the same locations. The way they're delivered are going to stay essentially the same. The way they're funded is going to potentially change. Thank you.
Did you have another comment then, Mr. Ross?
There's that.
I'm
going to,
thank you for giving me just a moment. I want to help you one last
question. Okay,
it's
make
kind
it
of
brief.
One minute.
Our time for here.
And I'm going to give this just for context. There's 271 municipalities in the state of Colorado. There's 24 with a population over 30,000. And of those, 11 of them are municipal fire departments. 11 of them are served by fire protection districts, and another two by fire authorities. The majority of major cities in this state are governed or protected by fire protection districts. That's how this state is protected. And they're everything from Fort Collins to Arvada to Broomfield, Commerce City, right up and down the line. This is not a new model. This is something that is the majority of what happens in this state, and there's a reason for it. It's because the fire protection districts bring a specific expertise to a very important public service, and that's all they do. Thank you.
Thank you. You have any questions?
Yeah, I've got a couple.
I have one.
I've got one, Mel. Are there any properties within the district, within the city, if we choose to allow the inclusion of the city, that you would not be able to serve?
I can't think of any. I would need somebody to point those out to me. At this point, I'd say no.
Okay, thank you.
Mel, if you want to stay there. So, assuming that the vote is approved by the citizens, is it contemplated that the assets that are currently owned by the city, including the firehouses, the real estate, the fire trucks, would transfer to the district?
Yes, that's been laid out in a pre-inclusion agreement that's been signed by both the district board and the city council.
And I know that there was a value put to that years ago. Any idea what that is?
No. There was some discussion on that, but and I may not get this exactly right, but there was some discussion about, well, do we need to value that? And we're like, well, why do we need to value it? Because the same people that have paid for it are going to be being serviced for it in the future, and they've already paid for it. So,
do you have any idea what the value is of the two fire stations, the real estate, and all of the apparatus?
I don't
the city
have
has
any
that
idea.
They'd be transferring
no.
to the district.
The one exception to the transfer of assets is going to be the downtown fire station. That is the station on the bottom and the police station on the top. That is going to remain with the city once if we transfer over and we build a new station.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Any other questions?
Not for you right
okay.
now.
Thank you.
I do have one for Eric. We chose to exclude some or all of the properties from the district, and or we chose to require an amendment to the service plan, where would that leave the district moving forward? Would that, in other words, would that take the election off the table?
Certainly in the short term, I believe so. I think that's the impact that those types of decisions would have on the district, is that it would cause a delay in the timing of...
So can you repeat that? I didn't understand the question.
If we chose to grant these exclusions...
The 451 or whatever they
are. Or if we chose to district-wide, what would the effect be on the district?
If we definitely did it district-wide, there wouldn't be an election.
Okay.
But anyhow, please finish.
I think it would cause a delay as to the timing of the district's plan to move this forward, both to the district court and the voters.
They would have to start the process over again.
With an amended service plan, yes, sir.
Okay. Mr. Weiss, you talk about the size of the tax increase. Is that actually relevant to whether or not we granted these exclusions?
Well, I think it's relevant to the requirement that there be a financial plan as part of the service plan. And
okay.
I'm just talking about, you know, the magnitude of it, yes.
Any more questions?
I have a question.
Eric, go ahead.
I have a question. Mr. Ross, thank you. It's great to be on this side, get to ask the questions rather than having to answer them. How do you respond to Mr. Weiss's comment or statement that this board, pursuant to statute, may exclude properties that be it property owners were not subject to the decision of exclusion? In other words, didn't file the petition.
Well, I think that you certainly could read the statute that way, but being an attorney, I also would strongly argue that that's not the intent of that statute. I think that language is intended to say that, however inartfully somebody petitions to exclude, the commissioners have the latitude to fashion exclusion around that property however they want to. I think it would be a gross misreading of that statute that would say that in a context like this where you have 400 petitions for excluding, that language says, oh, we can just exclude a couple thousand more. That's just way overbroad reading of that statute. There's nothing in there that would indicate that kind of just total discretion to exclude carte blanche the entire area of proposed inclusion. And by the way, you know, when we talk about these statutes, one thing that I would urge the commissioners to be cautious with, as well as we have been cautious with, is these are not well-crafted statutes. Okay? They're just not. And I lived with them for almost 30 years. We are talking about a district that was established in 1974. This is not a brand new district. This is not a new organization. So to sit here and try to pigeonhole a new organizational process into what is an exclusion process or a plan modification process to a district that's been around for 40 years is, to me, you know, a round peg in a square hole. This is a different breed. We have an established district that have been doing all of these services for years. And if you think we need to amend the service plan, why would you ask us to amend it on some theoretical basis that some point in the future we might include the city area? And then we have an amended service plan that may never actually apply to anything. That makes no sense to me whatsoever. What makes more sense is if you thought we needed to amend it, let the citizens vote. If they vote to include it, sure. We'll go ahead and include a map that says we've included the city, and we'll show the budget that's been shown to everybody at public meetings about what that new, you know, expanded area will look like. That's all that the statute requires. This isn't a new district organization, and there's no reason whatsoever to go through that process.
Okay, thank you.
While you're there.
Yes.
Does the district have the latitude to withdraw from the election at this time if they chose to?
Well, we are at such an early stage, the answer is absolutely yes. Okay. The board hasn't even adopted a resolution calling for the election.
Okay.
We continued that deliberation pending this board's determination of the two referred issues. And, you know, as to the earlier question to your counsel, of course, you know, I expect you to defer to your counsel, but if you excluded a couple properties, I don't know that our board wouldn't go ahead and go forward. You know, you carve out a half a dozen because you say, oh, let's exclude those. We're still, it would make probably economic and service sense to go ahead and do the rest, and we'll figure out what to do with the half dozen that we put a label on and say you don't get fire service. But why would we kill the whole thing by excluding one or two? And frankly, I don't think that's what they're asking for. They're saying exclude everything.
I think you've answered my question.
Okay. Any other questions?
No, not for me. I'm good.
I think that with that we'll close comments and
just go through our deliberation here and start going through our resolution. Who wants to lead off?
We do an inclusion exclusion first.
Yep, that sounds good.
I could go first or second.
Why don't you go first?
Okay.
I'll go first on the next on the.
Okay.
We've had experience with this fire stuff, so you know.
So I do think it's appropriate for us to weigh in on this because the historic version of us did create this district. And I think it's clear that, you know, the exclusion question versus the material modification question does probably put some more constraints around us because it does talk about burden in the statute. But it does say that the fire district has the burden to show that it's not in their best interest. And I didn't see that type of testimony put on the record. In fact, when I heard the fire chief talk, I heard him talk how it wouldn't be in the best interest of the property owners that were excluded, which is, you know, Mr. Ross made it very clear to us that we're not here to consider what's best for taxpayers or the county or the city. We're here to consider, you know, what is not in the best interest of the fire district. That was direct testimony that, hey, if a property owner gets themselves excluded, it's going to be really bad for them when the fire department shows up and lets their house burn to the ground. So, frankly, I didn't see the testimony put on the record that, you know, that the fire district met their burden of showing that it's not in their best interest. And I do think at this point, the whole question of, well, just let the voters decide, just let the voters decide, all it's doing is giving some of our county citizens a binary choice of yes or no of this one plan, which is, I believe, hasn't had a lot of public discussion. So it would be my inclination to say support the petitions for exclusion, and I could even say let's apply that to every property in the city.
It's hard to dispute what you just said in terms of, you're right, I guess I didn't hear a specific testimony on behalf of the fire district as to the case of whether or not it was in the best interest of the fire district to have these particular properties excluded. But having said that, it's clear to me that it would not be in the best interest of the district to have those properties excluded simply because the fire district failed to specifically address that. Doesn't actually change my opinion that it would not be in their best interest. And I think Mr. Ross said it well at the outlet, that this is a really narrow issue around the exclusion. I mean, it really is a binary choice for us to decide whether or not it is in the best interest of the fire district. So I would conclude the opposite.
One other thing that I'd like to point out is Mr. Ross just very clearly said at the end that even if we do grant the exclusion, it may be revenue so insignificant that they would move forward without it. So again, I think not only is the district not putting the evidence on the record that they need to meet their burden of proof, I think we've gotten some evidence from the district that actually contradicts their position. I'll just put that out there too.
Wow.
This is why you make a big one.
There you go. We are all anxiously awaiting your opinion.
Yeah, well, I'm going to have to side with Commissioner Corrigan. I think, you know, it's just intuitive that it's in the best interest for the fire district to not have these petitions. And again, as bad as this tastes in my mouth, this whole process, the Tabor bypass and the nine mills and the fire department and the switch and the rest of it, I can't see how we can approve the exclusion petitions based on the fact that, and again, maybe there wasn't that good of an argument, but I still believe it's not in the best interests as statutorily required of us that we allow those exclusions. So I would say that we deny the exclusion petitions. Again, I guess the other thing, and you know, this is also leaving a bad taste in my mouth as well, is the fact that, you know, whether there was some kind of education effort made on all these things, other than, you know, the effort was made by the council and some of the people, and then all the ones that we've getting letters from now that probably weren't included in the exclusions that all of a sudden come in the daylight that they didn't fill out their piece of paper. I mean, when I got mine on a piece of paper, I'm going, well, what the heck is this? So anyhow, I would have to say deny that for right now.
Okay. That sounds for my motion.
Do we want to do it in... Do we need to just do one motion on
yeah, because
it's one resolution. Yeah. So we'll take a global vote.
So who's going to lead off on the material modification?
I guess it's my turn. So I would start off with that I do agree with Mr. Weiss's assertion that this has been a flawed process. If I lived in the district, I would almost certainly vote against this based on the amount of tax increase based upon the process up to this point. But that's not what we're being asked to provide a judgment on today. Once again, this is a pretty narrow legal issue. We have to decide whether or not there's really been a material modification to the service plan. I think that the question before us is whether a change in the financing mechanism is a material modification. And I'm persuaded that that does not rise to the level of a material modification, that the services being provided are really, in essence, the same. So I would not support requiring or making a judgment that this rises to the level of a material modification.
So I believe it does, and I'm persuaded by Mr. Sharp's letter that if this isn't a material modification, I can't imagine what it would take to make it become material. I mean, just the plain meaning of that is, what would it take for it to become material? And the transfer of assets is significant, and I find it telling that the idea is, well, let's not even bother to quantify what those are worth because it's just paid for by the same taxpayer. And I suspect the reason that is because there was a quantification at one time, and it's in the tens of millions of dollars of assets that are being transferred from the control of the city council to the district. And so I believe that this is a material modification.
I guess I would wonder why the volume of assets that would be held by the district would somehow change the service level that was provided for in the original service plan.
I don't know the answer to that question, but I believe that it definitely goes to the material modification. I mean, it's even just the oversight from the elected officials, the city council, to the fire district. And I agree with Dino, Mr. Ross, that, you know, this is putting the cart before the horse to a certain extent, but and we've heard that from our own county attorney, but that's the way the statute's written. So this is our chance to weigh in on what does that service plan look like. I mean, what is the moving part of transferring everything essentially from the city into the district? That's material.
So I guess my take on it is I will have to say that it does not include a material modification as well. And I'm going to go off of that based on the fact that it's still the same people providing services. It's still going to be going to go into a different entity that's being now financed with the ill-gotten, in my mind, the Tabor situation and the nine mills and the rest. Our concern would be in the fact that if they couldn't finance the same level of services that they're going to be asked to provide that they've been providing through the city of Steamboat Springs. And I don't think that, hell, money's not a problem here. That's not the problem at all. So the problem is so I don't, the material modification, there is the same services being provided, the same services that we authorized in the 2015 adoption of the modified code and the rest. And I guess with that, I just would leave it at that, and I guess encourage everybody to go vote in May.
I guess I'm going to have to make a motion now.
I'll make the motion if you want, but we need a resolution number.
Yeah. 076.
I guess, yes, you better make it.
2000.
Okay. All right. You want me to make the motion?
Yeah, 2000. 076.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to approve resolution number 2018-076, resolution of the Board of County Commissioners officially final decision on matters referred by the Board of Directors of the Steamboat Springs Area Fire Protection District, noting recitals A, B, C, D, E, F, and G as listed in the resolution, and then now, therefore, having considered the documents and other materials submitted, the applicable law and the testimony provided at the November 13, 2018 public hearing, being resolved by the board as follows. Under item number one, exclusion petitions, the board denies the exclusion petitions, finding that the fire district has met its burden of proving the exclusion of the property set forth in Exhibit A from the fire district's proposed inclusion process is not in the best interest of the fire district. And under item two, material modification of service plan, the board finds that the fire district, the board finds the fire district's proposed inclusion does not constitute a material modification of the fire district's October 19, 2015 amended and restated service plan. The effective date of this resolution shall be November 13, 2018.
Second. Any other discussion?
Yes, sir. Does the board wish to have any additional comments added in the sections that the Commissioner Corrigan cited? There's a blank space.
No.
Thank you.
Did anybody have any other additional comments? Again, I guess my comment in closing before we vote here, I hope we're not done having this discussion. And again, I'm very sympathetic with the cause, all of it. I think I feel that my hands are being tied quite stringently behind my back. I haven't been able to exercise based on what I believe is my constitutional authority and what I have to work with. I'm not very happy with this. The commissioner's being put in the spot of this. At the same point in time, I'm going to support the resolution moving forward. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Opposed.
Thank you all for your time. Thank you, Mr. Sharp.